shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Contrary to their own current statistics, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is setting a guideline that says the term underrepresented can no longer be used to describe women and minorities in the workforce. The new guidelines, being set by the Bush administration and enforced by the commission, instructs managers at federal agencies to de-emphasize the statistical makeup of their staff when reaching out for new hires and considering promotions. The directive goes against commission statistics that say white males comprise 44% of the federal workforce, 26% are white females, 8% African American men, and 10% African American women. Hispanic men and women make up the remaining 6%. And at the senior pay level, 84% of the employees are white men. The commission says that the new directives will encourage managers to look beyond race and sex and look harder at the flaws of applicants. The NAACP is calling the new directives a retreat from the spirit of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
The Economic Policy Institute says George W. Bush is way off his prediction that his tax cuts would create 300,000 jobs a month. In September, just 96,000 were created. EPI's Lee Price says 150,000 are needed just to keep up with new people entering the workforce.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
EPI says jobs declined by 200,000 in September, and the official 5.4% jobless rate paints too rosy a picture. Since October of 2002, more than a fifth of workers have been jobless for at least 6 months. That is the most over that long a time since 1948.
Undeterred by rocketing global oil prices and a lockout implemented by their company, Norwegian oil workers are stepping up their three-month-long strike. 80 workers walked off the job yesterday, joining 600 others that have already walked off or have been locked out. The third-largest oil exporter has watched production drop by 2% since the strike started in July, and experts agree it will only get worse as the two sides try to stare each other down. The oil workers walked off demanding better working conditions from the Norwegian Shipowners Association. The company responded in September by locking out 200 additional workers. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Call centers have the highest turnover rates in this nation. The rate is 33%. That is 10% higher than the average job, according to Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Call center workers often find themselves in dreary working conditions where they are constantly monitored by employers and have to deal with abusive callers. Not to be mistaken for telemarketers, call center workers field calls for everything from prescription drug hotlines to setting up an installation date for the cable guy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So, Jasper, how was your year?
Excellent. This administration gives the best returns ever.
Do tell.
Well, the money I paid to a lobbying firm in Washington brought in over $50 million in overseas contracts.
Oh, yes, lobbying pays.
Are you still into commodities, Max?
No, I'm funding politicians. My campaign contributions got me over $100 million worth of regulation waivers.
Well done, Max.
Today's wisest investments are in politics. Where are you throwing your money?
Easily paid for by BillionairesForBush.com.
Thank you, Monsanto. Thank you, Scotts. These two pesticide giants have inadvertently demonstrated the scientific insanity of using our own Mother Nature as a lab rat in their rush to market bioengineered products. Monsanto and Scotts recently teamed up to genetically alter a turf grass called creeping bentgrass, primarily used on golf courses. The two corporations artificially manipulated the genes of this grass seed, not so the grass would require less water or less mowing, but solely so it can absorb greater doses of the company's pesticides, thus increasing corporate sales. But scientists warned that this altered grass would spread its pollen to faraway grasslands, displacing native species, creating superweeds, and, well, messing mightily with Mother Nature's delicate balance. "Oh, don't be such worrywarts," said the companies. "This grass has been thoroughly tested, so take a hike." But their so-called tests wouldn't get a passing grade at a high school science fair. One, for example, tested only a minuscule plot of 1/10 of an acre, finding that the pollen drifted only 1,400 feet, so no problem. Cute, but now a serious test has been done by the EPA. Quote, "This is one of the first really realistic studies that has been done," admits the guy who did the 1/10 of an acre testette. Indeed, this real test was on 400 acres, more like a real golf course would be. The pollen of these altered plants drifted not 1,400 feet, but at least 13 miles. What this makes clear is that the genetically altered corporate product is not only going to escape and contaminate our environment, but it'll do so, as one expert now concedes, a lot faster and a lot further than people anticipated. This is Jim Hightower saying, "It also makes clear that we can't trust corporations that base their global safety claims on 1/10 of an acre. To help fight their insanity, go to organicconsumers.org.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
It's a wild day here at the stock market. Let's talk to some traders. How are you doing?
I'm taking a shelling, but I'm still gelling.
Okay, and how about you?
I'm gelling and selling. Gelling and selling.
My trades are smelling.
But who cares?
We're gelling.
Are you gelling yet? Dr. Scholl's massaging gel insoles are made from the softest gel ever created. If you and your feet don't feel outrageously comfortable, you get your money back, guaranteed. Are you gelling? Dr. Scholl's. Know who's really gelling? The King of Queens. Monday through Friday. Check your local listings.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, happy Tuesday, friends. Patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border, on terrestrial radio stations from California to North Carolina, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, and streaming around the planet on radiopower.org with archives at White Rose Society, TomHartman.com. TomHartman.com, by the way, you can drop into our live chat room and interact with some of the wisest folks on the internet. However you want to take it. No, seriously, some really brilliant folks hanging out there and fascinating conversation. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. And Andy Borowitz gives us this breaking news. Political activist Ralph Nader's 11th-hour decision to run for president of Afghanistan has plunged that nation's first democratic election into chaos, raising fears that a final electoral result may not be known for months, if ever. Mr. Nader, frustrated that his poll numbers in the U.S. presidential race have been stuck at 2% for the past few months, made the decision last Thursday to shift his campaign to Afghanistan, where polls showed him garnering 3%.
traveling to Kabul with his entire campaign staff, consisting of two sophomores on leave from Oberlin College. Mr. Nader barnstormed his way across Afghanistan, hoping to pick up support from those Afghans displeased with the choice of candidates in their historic first election. But even as Mr. Nader denied that he was playing the role of spoiler, his quixotic bid for the presidency of Afghanistan seems to have siphoned off just enough votes from President Hamid Karzai to throw the election into Afghanistan's Supreme Court, which does not yet exist. Mr. Karzai was not the only one irked by Mr. Nader's long-shot candidacy, however, as angry warlords across the country vowed to hunt down the erstwhile consumer advocate and exact brutal revenge. Mohammed Mahki, an anti-Nader warlord in the western city of Herat, said, "I fought the Soviets, I fought the Taliban, and now I will fight Ralph Nader." Elsewhere, Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry said today that the New York Times misquoted him as saying that terror is a nuisance, explaining that what he actually said was Teresa is a nuisance. Mae West. By the way, John Kerry, I believe the last I heard, he was in Santa Fe, New Mexico yesterday. Perhaps he's still there preparing for his debate tomorrow night in, Tempe, I believe it is. And if you're still in Santa Fe and you happen to be listening to us at one of our affiliate stations, is KTRC in Santa Fe, so you may be within the sound of my voice, a small tip. This from one of our listeners in California, Dave. He notes Mae West in her last movie. She was about 90. And so she did the same thing that some are suggesting George W. does, you know, being wired for sound with a receiver under your clothes and a invisible earpiece. She was doing that. She was wired with an invisible earpiece because of difficulty remembering her lines at the age of 90. It was working pretty well at one point until she said, and she actually said this as it was being filmed. I mean, it's an outtake, but Blanca 79V, you'll be following TWA Jumbo for runway 27. Turns out they were in the proximity of LAX, and she was hearing an approach controller. So Dave says, if George W. is wired, does this give anyone any ideas? Oh, think what could be done. Think what could be. I don't want to go there. Coffee. I have not had my cup of coffee today. And one news story and he changes his life. Well, frankly, I never really liked coffee. My wife is addicted to it. But I was, you know, but here's this news story. This in Science News, the current issue just came out. Heavy coffee consumption appears to substantially increase an individual's risk of heart attack and sudden death, a Finnish study finds. Even occasional coffee drinkers are not off the hook. Those people had the highest blood pressure of any of the four groups studied, though they experienced only half the increase in serious heart events that heavy coffee drinkers endured. Well, still half. This is a study that goes back 14 years. Back in the 1980s, Pertti Happonen of the University of Kuopio, this is done in Finland, enrolled 40 to 60-year-old men, 2,000 of them, in a health study. Studied them for 14 years. And what they found was that men who drank 3.5 cups of coffee a day were 43% more likely to experience a heart attack. 1.5 cup a day reduced that by half, so that would have been 20%, roughly, I would guess. Men who abstained from coffee suffered the fewest heart problems. Although smoking aggravated heart disease in the coffee drinkers, the bruise effect was detectable even in men who never smoked. Interesting. So you heard it here first. Satellite. Now, what's going on in Iraq? This greeted me at 5 a.m. when I woke up this morning. BBC News. Satellite imagery. This is actually the CNN story. Satellite imagery shows buildings that once housed high-precision equipment that could be used to make nuclear bombs have been dismantled. The International Atomic Energy Agency said in a letter to the UN Security Council. Get this. There were several buildings that back in 1991, after the Gulf War, were identified by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, as containing equipment that could be used to make bombs, nuclear bombs. We're talking about, you know, high precision laser guided lathes and, you know, contraptions. They're called dual use devices. They can also be used to make other things, but specifically, you know, pulled together in one place and organized the way they were. They were for making nuclear weapons. And the IAEA locked this place down, put stamps on all of the machines. I heard the interview this morning on BBC with the guy from the IAEA who actually did it. And apparently they attached those kinds of little foil tags on a wire like you have on the electric meter in your home to each piece of machinery with a serial number stamped on it. And that way, they would, you know, when they did their periodic inspections, they could just make sure that the numbers were intact, because if anybody had messed with the thing, it would damage the seal. I mean, it's the same way your power company knows whether you've hacked your meter. So they had these things all over all these machines, and they were in several buildings, and they knew where the buildings were, and they knew that the machines were there, and they'd been just gathering dust for a decade. And the IAEA knew this, and we knew this, everybody knew this, Saddam disclosed this, it was, you know, under control. Well, when we, in March, when we attacked, March of last year, when we attacked Iraq, we asked the IAEA and the UN weapons inspectors to leave. And since then, we have not asked them, not only have not asked them to not come back, but we have told them not that they can't come back. In fact, as to quote CNN, the American government prevented UN weapons inspectors from returning to Iraq, thereby blocking the IAEA from monitoring the high-tech equipment and materials after the U.S.-led war was launched in March of 2003. So, since the invasion, the Bush administration has turned down IAEA offers to return. Now, the country of Iraq, which is now under the control of Alawi, is required by international law, by the famous UN sanctions, the UN Security Council resolutions, they're required to notify the IAEA if this equipment moves, anything happens to it. And the IAEA has gotten no notification whatsoever. The Iraqi government hasn't told them. The U.S. government hasn't told them. And they've been looking at satellite photos, and they just noticed that the buildings that were holding these things have vanished. I mean, they didn't just cart out the equipment. They even took the buildings. What do you want to bet they're in Iran? I mean, this is from our satellite photos. This from one of the IAEA people here, Mark Guadzecki in Vienna, Austria. He says, from our satellite photos, we've seen evidence that some of the facilities we used to monitor closely have been dismantled completely, indicating that it happened over a long period of time with more forethought. He doesn't think it was just random looting. He said, we need to answer the question, where did this material go? Apparently, the Bush administration is clueless. Saddam, as Colin Powell said, as Don Rumsfeld said before 9/11, right after they came into office, actually, it was in February or March of 2001, each of them in their own ways said, Saddam is in a box. Actually, one of them used that exact phrase. I think it was Powell. Turns out he was. Moving along, tomorrow night we're going to have the presidential debate, the first one that's going to be hosted by Bob Schieffer, CBS News' first whack at this thing. And I know there's some folks out on the left out there who are, you know, running emails around the internet. Bob Schieffer, you know, his brother is involved with the Republicans somehow or something like this, a whole conspiracy theory around him. Frankly, I suspect Bob Schieffer is going to be very impartial. I don't think that he is a particularly political guy. I mean, I've been watching him report the news for, it seems like, the better part of 30 years, maybe longer. So I'm not, frankly, too concerned about that. But, you know, what would the questions be? Here's a question that the ReclaimDemocracy.org folks have put forward. And I'm going to actually give you the setup, and then I'll give you the question after the break here. After years of effort by large corporations, in 1886, the Supreme Court granted corporations civil rights previously reserved only to citizens, in effect creating corporate personhood. Since then, corporations have used our Bill of Rights to override laws that protect our health, safety, and welfare, contrary to the intent of the Founding Fathers. The interpretation of free speech has been modified and extended to include corporate spending to influence elections and legislation. Many, including former Supreme Court justices, believe that corporate personhood is unconstitutional and it denies citizens the right to participate equally in a majority rule system. Well, here's the question. Do you believe it's important enough to protect citizens' rights and power to govern that if you are elected president, you will issue an executive order directing all executive branch agencies to treat corporations strictly as business entities with no inherent civil rights, and direct the Department of Justice to argue against corporate civil rights in courts, and thereby restore the rights of citizens to participate equally in the majority rule system? Can we have our human rights back, please? Mr. Kerry, Mr. Bush, your thoughts on this? I think it's a pretty important issue. In fact, it may be the most important issue. Probably the only one that won't get brought up. 20 minutes after.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about the Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
For more than 27 years, the Progressive magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. Author and broadcast personality Studs Terkel calls In These Times his bi-weekly tonic. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. 1-800-827-0270.
Who is it?
Special delivery.
Who?
Pizza Man.
Hey, you're not the Pizza Man. You're the cable guy again.
Price Patrol.
No, you're not. I can see your van. You're the cable company. I'm not going to let you raise my rates again. I'm calling American Satellite to get a DirecTV system.
Presidential candidate.
Are you going to offer me over 125 digital quality channels for as little as $39.99 a month, including my local channels?
Ice Cream Man.
Yeah, like that's going to work. If I call American Satellite right now, I can get a four-room DirecTV system, including professional installation free. Can you beat that?
Pizza Man.
You already tried that. Well, that's it. I'm calling to get my DirecTV system.
Call 800-505-1546. That's 800-505-1546. For new customers only. Annual programming commitment required. Ask how you can get your first 6 months for only $29.99 a month, a $60 value. Offer ends July 17th. Call now. 800-505-1546.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
We'll be fighting in the streets with our children at our feet.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Should corporations have civil rights? You say, is this some sort of exotic, weird little legal argument? No, this thing impacts every aspect of your life and mine. Every moment, every aspect of our lives. And it didn't used to be this way. When this country was set up, the founders were very, very clear. They understood absolutely clearly that the history of civilization, as it were, the history of governance in the hands of kings, of theocratic popes and mullahs, and of what feudal times of the rich, as it were, Alexander Hamilton referred to as the barons, the warlord kings, popes, and the barons. In all cases, they claimed that they held the rights, and that the people had only privileges. And they got to decide what those privileges were for the people. And when the founders came along in 1776, they had this radical new idea that had only really in any significant way been tried once before, and that was in Athens, Greece, a couple thousand years earlier. And it only lasted a few hundred years, which made everybody very skeptical that we, the people, would hold the rights. And that the kings or the popes or that, you know, anybody else wants to get into this thing, they're going to only have privileges. They're not going to have rights. That we are the sole holders of the rights. So if anybody among us wants to get together and create an institution, whether it's a corporation, a church, a civic club, even a government, it will have only privileges. We hold the rights. And that's the way it was from 1776 forward until, oddly enough, 1886. In 1886, along came this very bizarre Supreme Court ruling, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, in which the United States Supreme Court is said to have said that under the 14th Amendment, which was written to free the slaves after the Civil War, which says you cannot deny anybody equal protection under the law, that corporations were entitled to equal protection under the law with humans. In other words, corporations were entitled to civil rights as well. Not churches, not government, not unions, just corporations. And then, you know, it's gone on from there. Now corporations have claimed that, you know, in Boston v. Bilotti in 1978, they claimed the right to have free speech rights, First Amendment rights, and therefore they can influence elections. And they said that, you know, well, we don't have a mouth to speak with, but we do have money. So the Supreme Court said, okay, well, money is a right. Money equals speech. Fourth Amendment, Dow Chemical sued the EPA, said you can't inspect us without us giving permission. We have a right of privacy. Supreme Court said, well, I guess if you're a person, I guess you do have a right of privacy. JCPenney in 1936 wanted to move into Florida. They wanted to, you know, like Walmart does. Florida, communities in Florida were resisting. They were passing laws against it. The state of Florida had passed a higher tax for out-of-state corporations. JCPenney sued at the Supreme Court. JCPenney versus Florida in 1936. And the court said, well, corporations are persons. I guess you have civil rights. You can't be discriminated against. The state doesn't have the right to say, well, we're going to treat our domestic corporations, our in-state corporations, better than you. And it turns out it was all based on a lie. The Supreme Court never ruled that. They never decided that. Instead, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, the clerk of the Supreme Court, wrote that in a headnote, a commentary on the case. He opened the headnote by saying, corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection under the law, and it was never ruled by the Supreme Court. And yet, it's the law today, or it's the policy today, let's say. And it's enabled, it has produced all this extraordinary corruption that we are seeing right now. I'll share with you the consequence of this and what we can do about it right after this.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.org.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Contrary to their own current statistics, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is setting a guideline that says the term underrepresented can no longer be used to describe women and minorities in the workforce. The new guidelines, being set by the Bush administration and enforced by the commission, instructs managers at federal agencies to de-emphasize the statistical makeup of their staff when reaching out for new hires and considering promotions. The directive goes against commission statistics that say white males comprise 44% of the federal workforce. 26% are white females, 8% African American men, and 10% African American women. Hispanic men and women make up the remaining 6%. And at the senior pay level, 84% of the employees are white men. The commission says that the new directives will encourage managers to look beyond race and sex and look harder at the flaws of applicants. The NAACP is calling the new directives a retreat from the spirit of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
The Economic Policy Institute says George W. Bush is way off his prediction that his tax cuts would create 300,000 jobs a month. In September, just 96,000 were created. EPI's Lee Price says 150,000 are needed just to keep up with new people entering the workforce.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
EPI says jobs declined by 200,000 in September, and the official 5.4% jobless rate paints too rosy a picture. Since October of 2002, more than a fifth of workers have been jobless for at least 6 months. That is the most over that long a time since 1948.
Undeterred by rocketing global oil prices and a lockout implemented by their company, Norwegian oil workers are stepping up their three-month-long strike. 80 workers walked off the job yesterday, joining 600 others that have already walked off or have been locked out. The third-largest oil exporter has watched production drop by 2% since the strike started in July, and experts agree it will only get worse as the two sides try to stare each other down. The oil workers walked off, demanding better working conditions from the Norwegian Shipowners Association. The company responded in September by locking out 200 additional workers. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Call centers have the highest turnover rates in this nation. The rate is 33%. That is 10% higher than the average job, according to Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Call center workers often find themselves in dreary working conditions where they are constantly monitored by employers and have to deal with abusive callers. Not to be mistaken for telemarketers, call center workers field calls for everything from prescription drug hotlines to setting up an installation date for the cable guy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. We're finding now increasingly things like stories like the researchers in the FDA who were raising flags about Vioxx or about antidepressants in suicidal kids, Vioxx and heart attacks or the other COX-2 inhibitors, that they were being pressured, they were being ostracized, they were being subject to veiled threats, intimidation. Strong words. These are actual quotes from a physician at the FDA Drug Center's Office of Drug Safety, Dr. David J. Graham, reported by Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Ohio, yesterday. And, you know, what's going on with this? Well, it turns out, for example, the statin drugs, you know, these drugs that are supposed to lower cholesterol that are so heavily advertised on TV. I have a good friend who has been experiencing just incredible pain for a number of years. Turned out it was because he was taking one of these statin drugs, and he was just having this just muscle pain that was just awesome all over his body. I mean, just terrible, you know, brilliant, like bright, like painful. And turned out it was a side effect of this drug, and he stopped taking the drug, and it took like a year or so for this to slowly start to fade away and for him to recover. And, you know, frankly, I'm not sure that he's fully recovered, but because, you know, he still complains about it from time to time. But 8 of the 9 authors, it turns out, of the recommendations to the National Institute of Health's National Cholesterol Education Program that urged millions of Americans to take more of these kinds of drugs, 8 of the 9 authors had financial ties to statin manufacturers, including Pfizer, Merck, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and AstraZeneca. And this fact, according to the Center for Science and the Public Interest, was not disclosed when the recommendations were first published in the journal Circulation. Corporate behavior in the United States, and it's not, we're not talking the company in your hometown. I'm not talking about the small business or even a medium-sized business. I'm not talking about a business in your city or your state. We're talking about huge multinational corporations, probably fewer than 1,000 of them, have run amok. They are corrupting science. They're corrupting the media. Here you got Sinclair Broadcasting, the largest owner of television stations in the United States. Going to run an hour long. This here's your October surprise, folks. Somebody run and post it to our message board and get on the contest, right? But I'm telling you, I think this is the October surprise. At least I think so right now. That this was well planned. I have no problem with these guys playing an anti-carry thing for an hour if they follow it with Fahrenheit 9/11 or Going Up River, the new documentary about John Kerry. But to just lay out one side of the story and then to call it news, give me a break. Let's take a couple calls and then we'll continue with this topic. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Alan in Texas is on the line. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Yes, when I go and get fuel at one of our trucking terminals,
yes, sir.
I have to punch my Social Security number into a machine, and I feel like it has nothing to do with Social Security. What do you think about that?
When did this start, Alan?
Oh, it's been 4 years ever since I've been with the company.
Yeah. Well, I think it's wrong, frankly. When I was a kid, in the 50s and 60s, there was actually a law that said that a company could not require you to use your Social Security number as an ID number. That went by the boards, and as I recall, in the late 70s. And now there are, places that require it. I know of some people who, for example, when they get health insurance or when they, anything that has to do with a business, not the government, because the government, particularly Social Security Administration, asks for the number. You got to give them the right number. But where companies are asking for a number and they'll have a, a second number that's, you know, one digit off from the main number that they, from their actual number that they'll use, just to screw with the system or something. I don't think that any corporation, frankly, should have my Social Security number. It's none of their business.
Yeah, I agree with you. Also, when you go in a cell phone these days, they ask for your Social Security number.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're using it increasingly to do credit checks. And, you know, you run the risk if you give them a phony Social Security number that they're going to pull up, somebody else's Social Security number and discover that you're really a prostitute working in Vegas or something. Might not be the greatest thing for you, if that's the case. But you get the wrong Social Security number. But, it's a tough one, Alan. I really think it's time for us to start raising these issues about our rights to privacy. We had Justice Scalia here in Vermont last week. And, in fact, I just wrote a piece about this and submitted it to commondreams.org today, saying that there is no right to privacy. He says, you got no right to privacy. You want a right to privacy, pass a law. And it's a rant I'm going to get into in the second hour of the program, but it's just wrong. We are seeing, particularly under this administration, but it's not unique to Bush and it's not unique even to the Republicans, we have been seeing in the last 20, 30 years in the United States in particular ever since the 1980s, a rapid and steady erosion of our rights of privacy.
Yeah, we need to take back our party and our country.
I agree. Alan, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. Dan in San Jose, California on the line. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wondered what you think about, I know it's kind of a radical idea, are people on the left maybe afraid to talk about the possibility of Bush being complicit in 9/11? Because it answers a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I wonder if people are afraid to kind of explore that issue and it's alluded to in a lot of literature and movies.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are reluctant to explore it out loud and out in the open. I mean, certainly there are books out talking about this, and there's no shortage of websites talking about it. And I've read a lot of this stuff. I'm frankly not of the opinion that Bush in any way was involved in 9/11 or anybody in the administration, but it does appear pretty obvious that they had all kinds of screaming warnings before 9/11, and they did nothing. And, in fact, they even obstructed. I mean, you read Bob Graham's book. They obstructed investigations into the Saudis that could have caught these Saudi citizens, these 15 Saudi citizens who flew these airplanes into these towers. And we don't know why. We don't know why they obstructed that. We don't know if... I mean, we just don't know why. And I would like some of those answers, some of those questions answered. We don't have those answers. Whether it was, because here's the thing that bothers me about this, Dan. In 1998, the Project for a New American Century, the neocon think tank that was put together. Well, we don't need to go through the whole history of it. But anyhow, in 1998, they signed this letter to Bill Clinton demanding that he attack Iraq immediately. It was signed by Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Don Rumsfeld, all these neocons, right?
So 9/11 would be an instrument to get Americans to support a war against so-called terror.
They actually said that. They said that, you know, it's probably unlikely that America will support an invasion of Iraq without a Pearl Harbor type of incident.
Right.
I mean, this is in their literature.
Do you think people are afraid that by bringing this up that it plays into the hands of the right?
No, I think most of us don't want to even allow our minds to go into the possibility that such a horrific thing could have been countenanced, could have been allowed by the people who are running our government. And like I said, I have a real hard time with it. It presupposes a level of psychopathology that's beyond what any of us are willing to imagine would be at the highest levels of government.
What are the possibilities that after, if, say, Kerry takes office, that in further investigations and perhaps criminal investigations can be taken into the Bush administration?
You know, I frankly suspect if Kerry wins, and particularly if he gets either the House, the Senate, or both in Democratic hands, Well, whether he does or he doesn't, he's going to have his hands full. First of all, it would take one of the branches of Congress being in Democratic hands to institute an investigation, number one. And I do think that there should be an investigation so that we can get the answers to some of these questions. Whether or not these guys should be prosecuted depends on what the investigation turns up. I'm not into the kind of Republican against Clinton revenge line, you know, bring them down at any cost, that kind of thing. Frankly, I think that, you know, Kerry's attitude probably is going to be, let's just move on. We've got, the problems that George Bush has created that Kerry's going to have to deal with. You're talking, you know, a $3 trillion debt, mind-boggling trade deficits. We're sucking down oil so fast. I mean, it's like we've become, we're like heroin addicts to the Middle East. All the environment crashing around us. Now we've got, you know, stories about carbon spikes in the atmosphere. I mean, there are some real serious issues that he's going to have to deal with, that the next president is going to have to deal with. And, prosecuting the former president is probably going to be the least among them. And I would say rightly so. Let's find out.
Yeah, I mean, you're saying let's take one step at a time and worry about winning it, and then going on and not letting him ruin the country more by being distracted and not fixing the problems that are more important.
Yeah, and also, you know, there's a certain level of backfire in all this. I mean, even if you can demonstrate some complicity and you go after them and prosecute them, you're going to have some folks who are going to say, oh, no, they're after my team, and it's going to further divide the country.
They're going to politicize it.
Right. Well, it will be politicized, and that broadly, that's not a good thing. So, I suspect, and I may be wrong, but I mean, it's kind of the liberal worldview, as it were, that it's better to heal and move on than to sit around and complain and beat somebody over the head over and over and over just for the joy of doing it. I mean, that's the sort of thing that the cons love to do. It's not generally, I think, the sort of thing that you see liberals or progressives doing. They're really more interested in getting things done.
Well, thanks a lot for letting me share that with you.
Sure. Good question, Dan. Thanks for calling. I appreciate it. 16 minutes before the hour, let's go to Paul in Santa Fe. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Something about the Sinclair Broadcasting Group.
Yeah.
One thing I've done, I'm originally from Ohio in the Dayton area. They have they own two stations in the Dayton market, a Fox station and an NBC station.
Uh-huh.
And I emailed some activist friends there, and they're going to call up the local stations and tell them, you know, they're going to look at their local advertisers and boycott those advertisers if they air the propaganda piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think basically hitting them where it hurts, the pocketbook, is about the only way that, or perhaps the most effective way to get these things not to be aired.
I don't disagree with you, but what they know is that that'll go away. You know, they'll get through that. I mean, what you've got here is and in fact they're mobilizing on the other side. Here's this I just have to share this with you. This is from this is a conservative alert that I got in email it says to rush at eib.net. I mean, anyhow, it's from some guy named Mosley, and in fact we need our conservative alert music. Sinclair Broadcasting will air Stolen Honor, a documentary of John Kerry's anti-Vietnam activities after returning from Vietnam and several key battleground states. We need your help to defend the Constitution. The liberals are out for blood. The Sinclair Broadcasting Group is under vicious attack by the wacko left trying to suppress free speech, as liberals always do. The civil rights left is desperately trying to censor and silence the truth about John Kerry. The screaming lefties are trying to pressure Sinclair to back down by boycotting Sinclair's advertisers, filing FCC complaints, and harassing Sinclair's manager. First, the left is pressuring mutual funds to dump Sinclair's stock, to pressure Sinclair into not telling the truth about John Kerry. So if you can, please buy Sinclair's stock. And they give the SBGI is the stock symbol. If you know any companies or political groups that can advertise on Sinclair's television stations, please urge them to advertise on Sinclair. And they go on, they say, email your support to Sinclair's management. And here's the private email of the president of Sinclair. dsmith@sbgnet.com, dsmith at sbg as in sugar bravo george net.com. That's the email for David Denniston Smith, the fellow who in 1996 was arrested and charged with committing an unnatural and perverted sex act in a company-owned Mercedes in an undercover sting operation at Reed and St. Paul Streets, a downtown corner frequented by prostitutes in Baltimore. Police say Mary, 31, ran across the street to his Mercedes, registered to Sinclair, got in on the passenger side. Police followed the car into the Jones Fall Expressway, where they said they witnessed the two engage in sex while Smith drove north. So, that's everything I know on that, eh? Your thoughts?
No, well, I know. I think the Democrats are, what are they, have taken this to the FCC,
yeah.
I do believe.
Yeah, it's, well, there's, I believe so. I'm not absolutely certain. I know that there's discussion of that, and, you know, I've seen that, but.
Yeah, but I'd imagine it probably will air, but, you know, hopefully either some other station will air, like you say, Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah, except nobody else owns as many TV stations in the United States, and all of these, or virtually all these stations, are in major, major markets. I mean, I've got a list of them here in Sacramento, California, Las Vegas, San Antonio, Oklahoma, Minneapolis, Des Moines, Nashville, Birmingham, Flint, Michigan, Springfield, Illinois, Champaign, you know, and on and on and on it goes. You know, some medium and major markets, and it's not going to happen. I guarantee you, nobody else is going to be airing Fahrenheit 9/11 in rebuttal to it. It's not going to happen. Odds are, Paul, these guys are going to get away with this.
Yeah, I think so. Got to run.
Okay, thanks for the call. And this is just another example what happens when corporations have so much influence, so much power, that they can rig the rules. That they can go to the FCC and say, you know, those rules that you have that say that our news has to actually be news, that we have to actually serve our community, why don't you change those? And so you get, you know, the second most corporate-friendly administration in history, the Reagan administration, said, yeah, good idea. We'll do away with all that stuff back in 86 and 87. And then, you know, of course, Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act. You know, on it rolls, right? The corporate steamroller. We're a corporation, we're a person. We can speak, you can't. And on it goes. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bonjour, my name is Veronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you 3 of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
When you look at a forest, do you see pretty flowers and cute little critters hopping around? Well, when we billionaires look at a forest, we see redwood decks, teak furniture, and reams of bleached white paper. We look at all the untapped natural resources available, and we see opportunity where others can't see the forest for the trees. Aren't you bored of tree huggers whining about the precious old-growth forests? Don't they understand the law of supply and demand? The more trees we clear cut, the more scarce we make them, and the more valuable they become as a commodity. So the next time you hear the buzz of chainsaws, know the billionaires are giving Mother Nature more bang for her buck. I'm Zena Fope for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Kick up the billionaire!
We the people now face a fundamental choice. Take back our government or do nothing and become the victims of tyranny and empire.
That is the message in a revealing new book by Tom Hartman, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Fully illustrated by Neil Cohn, We the People takes a hard look at America's past, present, and future. you'll find out that the Patriot Act is not unique. In 1798, President John Adams pushed the Alien and Sedition Act through a Federalist Congress, enabling him to have his unpatriotic critics arrested and imprisoned, putting numerous opposition newspapers out of business. While a bit more subtle, Hartman says, this administration is likewise attempting to suppress any criticism, to eradicate any opposition. Progressive talk show host Janine Garofalo says, read this book for a jolt of illumination. We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Farmers in 17th century New England struck a steady balance between their community and the market, according to a new book. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Market forces dominate agriculture along with most other aspects of American life, too much so in the opinion of environmental historian Brian Donahue. He's written a new book called The Great Meadow, Farmers and the Land in Colonial Concord. Donahue says the market began to exert a heavy influence in 18th century New England. He says farmers were pulled by two competing forces. One was the traditional mixed husbandry of English family farms, raising livestock, crops, vegetables, fruit, and firewood. Farmers grew what the family needed, and maybe a little extra to take to market. The other force was the growing opportunity to earn profits by specializing in a few crops or commodities to sell. Donahue says it was agriculture as a way of life versus agriculture as a business, but he says Concord farmers maintained a balance between these forces through the 1600s. He says they managed their property with a sense of responsibility to their families and their community. These colonial farmers did manage a healthy level of economic growth while farming for many generations on the same land. Donahue concludes that this sustainable agriculture was framed by a number of social restraints, including responsibility to one's family, neighbors, and community, and the fact that most of what they needed had to be produced locally. Donahue says these early Americans had their faults, and he wouldn't endorse their Puritan social restraints, but he says the colonial farmers did manage to strike a balance between the market and their community, a balance he says has been lost over the last 200 years. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Is the Tom Hartman Program.
We honor and respect our troops and hold our flag up high. But please don't make them shed their blood for nothing but a lie.
Welcome back. 4.5 minutes before the hour. MediaChannel.org is the conservative website that will help you out if you want to communicate with Sinclair or its advertisers. They've set up a page for people who want to support Sinclair, telling them how to contact their advertisers. And so you can check that out, MediaChannel.org. And, you know, it's go as you wish. Exxon, here, this the same thing. Exxon is mailing its 34,000 employees. This used to be illegal. Seriously. This used to be against the law. It used to be, you know, political action by a corporation was a crime. Teddy Roosevelt campaigned on this. I'm talking about in 1904? Exxon is mailing its 34,000 employees with election materials and helpful voter guides, which, surprise, give the Republican Party gold star ratings for spurning global warming regulation, supporting drilling for oil in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and letting oil refineries release more pollution by weakening the Clean Air Act. This from Greenpeace, Greenpeace's website. Exxon is informing not only its employees, but also retirees and contractors how they should vote in upcoming presidential and congressional races across the United States. Ken Cohen, the vice president for public affairs and the chairman of ExxonMobil's PAC, Political Action Committee, said, quote, Republicans often tend to line up on these issues better than Democrats, end quote. He's talking about issues of interest to Exxon, of course. In 2000, Exxon gave 91%, sort of like Sinclair Broadcasting, 91%, this was $1.37 million, of its political donations to the Republican Party. Exxon was more than amply rewarded when President George W. Bush promptly withdrew the U.S. from the only global treaty to control global warming, the Kyoto Protocol. CEO Lee Raymond, this is the chief executive officer of Exxon, says, "It is important that we as a company, and more importantly as individuals, are part of the political process." We as a company are part of the political process? Companies do not vote. Last I looked, corporations do not have a vote. You can't elect a corporation. Now, Mussolini did. Mussolini dissolved Parliament and replaced it with the Parliament of Fascist Corporations. That's what it was called. And corporations were the representatives. Corporations got to send their representatives, and they ran Parliament. That's called fascism. We said in the United States for almost 200 years, we said, no, rather not have that. Are we going back? Are we going backwards? Scary, strange times, my friends. Get involved. Get active.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way: to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Contrary to their own current statistics, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is setting a guideline that says the term underrepresented can no longer be used to describe women and minorities in the workforce. The new guidelines, being set by the Bush administration and enforced by the commission, instructs managers at federal agencies to de-emphasize the statistical makeup of their staff when reaching out for new hires and considering promotions. The directive goes against commission statistics that say white males comprise 44% of the federal workforce, 26% are white females, 8% African American men, and 10% African American women. Hispanic men and women make up the remaining 6%. And at the senior pay level, 84% of the employees are white men. The commission says that the new directives will encourage managers to look beyond race and sex and look harder at the flaws of applicants. The NAACP is calling the new directives a retreat from the spirit of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
The Economic Policy Institute says George W. Bush is way off his prediction that his tax cuts would create 300,000 jobs a month. In September, just 96,000 were created. EPI's Lee Price says 150,000 are needed just to keep up with new people entering the workforce.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
EPI says jobs declined by 200,000 in September, and the official 5.4% jobless rate paints too rosy a picture. Since October of 2002, more than a fifth of workers have been jobless for at least 6 months. That is the most over that long a time since 1948.
Undeterred by rocketing global oil prices and a lockout implemented by their company, Norwegian oil workers are stepping up their three-month-long strike. 80 workers walked off the job yesterday, joining 600 others that have already walked off or have been locked out. The third-largest oil exporter has watched production drop by 2% since the strike started in July, and experts agree it will only get worse as the two sides try to stare each other down. The oil workers walked off, demanding better working conditions from the Norwegian Shipowners Association. The company responded in September by locking out 200 additional workers. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Call centers have the highest turnover rates in this nation. The rate is 33%. That is 10% higher than the average job, according to Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Call center workers often find themselves in dreary working conditions where they are constantly monitored by employers and have to deal with abusive callers. Not to be mistaken for telemarketers, call center workers field calls for everything from prescription drug hotlines to setting up an installation date for the cable guy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So, Jasper, how was your year?
Excellent. This administration gives the best returns ever.
Do tell.
Well, the money I paid to a lobbying firm in Washington brought in over $50 million in overseas contracts.
Oh, yes, lobbying pays.
Are you still into commodities, Max?
No, I'm funding politicians. My campaign contributions got me over $100 million worth of regulation waivers.
Well done, Max.
Today's wisest investments are in politics. Where are you throwing your money?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
In monarchies, the peasants are not even supposed to speak to the royals unless spoken to. In democracies, however, folks are supposed to be free to speak their minds to those in power. That's what Sue Niederer of Hopewell, New Jersey, tried to do. Earlier this year, her 24-year-old son Seth was killed in Iraq while trying to defuse a roadside bomb. Angry is not a strong enough word to describe her emotions. Mad as hell and not going to take it is a phrase that comes closer to Sue's feelings. To express those feelings, she attended a Laura Bush political rally near her home. She wore a politically incorrect T-shirt emblazoned with a picture of Seth and the words, "President Bush killed my son." As Laura pattered on about the heroic nature of her husband's war on terrorism, Miss Niederer hollered out an uninvited but totally legitimate question. If the war is so essential to our national security, why aren't the Bush daughters enlisting in it? Raw ugliness erupted. Bush partisans immediately surrounded this distraught lady, shouting 4 more years over and over while waving their Bush-Cheney signs at her. Hello, she lost her son in Bush's war of lies, and this is the respect she gets from the Bushites? Worse, the police handcuffed her, hauled her to jail, and booked her for trespassing. Of course, the charge was ludicrous and later had to be dropped, but the Bushites are still after her. Now, Bush's Secret Service is investigating Sue, claiming she threatened the president's life. What she did, in an understandable fit of anger, was to say on a website that she'd like to rip the president's head off and shoot him in the groin area. Of course, she didn't mean the comments literally, yet the vindictive Bushites are using them as an excuse to hound and try to destroy her. This is Jim Hightower saying, to tell the monarchy of King George W. to leave Sue Niederer alone, call the White House comment line, 202-456-1111.
I have these nightmares. This taco, not just an ordinary taco, but this big evil taco is haunting me.
Guacamole.
You see, I was exposed to credit cards in college, and I wasn't the most responsible person back then.
Go, go, go!
I mean, I heard the words credit card and thought, hey, hey, free money! Plane ticket to spring break? Credit card. New skis? Credit card. 135 taco dinners? Bam! Credit card. But hey, it's not too late to do something about your credit. Get ScorePower from Equifax.com. ScorePower gives you your credit report, credit score, and it puts you on the road toward the credit you deserve for just $14.95. So, check out Equifax.com today and get that taco you ate 7 years ago out of your life.
Get ScorePower at Equifax.com or 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Adios, taco.
Get the power. ScorePower at Equifax.com.
Calling for
for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Folks in the chat room mentioning, this just reminded me, who was it who said it? Klana53142 says, watching the debate and talking in chat at the same time was fun. A bunch of folks in our chat room got together during the last debate, Tuesday? Whenever it was. That's how memorable these things are. Anyhow, during the last debate, some of the folks in our chat room got together. And no, it was Friday, wasn't it? Got together and listened in, watched the chat room, watched the debate, and participated in the chat room with each other. The chat room is open 24/7, and you are more than welcome to use it anytime you'd like. Just go to TomHartman.com and click on the button that says Live Chat. It will take you to the Democratic Forum on CompuServe, right into the chat module, as it were. If you don't have a CompuServe or AOL account, you put in your screen name and your password, and boom, you're in. And if you don't, then you can just sign up right there. It's not like signing up for a service. It's not like you don't have to give them a credit card. There's no financial transaction at all. The only thing you have to give is your email account, and that's so that they can mail you a password and so that we can have some level of security in the chat room, you know, so it doesn't get spammed and stuff. Real people are there. But that's it. It's very simple, very straightforward. And during the debate tomorrow night, I invite you to drop by. I will be there. Arcata, California, hats off. I believe I'm quite sure Arcata, California is in the listening area of KGOE, one of our affiliate stations. This one in Northern California. In fact, I think it's in Arcata. Maybe I'm wrong. But in any case, here's this story that was passed along to me from the Arcata Times-Standard. In a decision sure to resonate for at least a couple of miles, the Arcata City Council has passed a resolution calling for President Bush to be impeached. The tiny coastal hamlet took a vote of council members late Wednesday and passed the resolution 3-0. The council says Bush violated numerous international laws in waging war against Afghanistan and Iraq. The resolution states in part that Arcata should be seen as an example for other cities looking to rebuff, quote, the imperial goals of power-crazed leaders, end quote. The city tried to pass a similar resolution calling for the impeachment of Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney last year, but failed. So this time they came back, just Bush. The problem that I have with these things, with impeaching Bush, is that you end up with Cheney. And people say, well, impeach them both. Well, then you end up with Denny Hastert. And that's even scarier, frankly. In some ways, who would be fourth after Denny Hastert? I'm not sure how that would work in the case of a dual impeachment. I have to go back and look at my secession table. Anyhow, it's the war on terror starts at the pump. This is a marvelous article from the New York Times News Service. I believe it was first published as an editorial in the New York Times. The copy that I have does not have an attribution. My recollection was that it was Crystal, but I could be wrong. The Bush energy policy should be called No Moolah Left Behind. And, you know, what a good point. In the Arab world, you have one country, basically, that is working on labor reform. Bahrain. They just signed a free trade agreement with the United States. They just had the first elections in the Gulf region. And women were allowed to vote. Now, at the same time, today, we learned that Saudi Arabia, the Saudi kingdom, the Saudi royal family, including Bandar Bush, the Saudi ambassador to the United States and a cousin of George W. Bush by attribution, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia has decided that they are, in fact, going to hold elections next year. However, women cannot run for office. Not only that, they've decided women can't even vote for who gets to run for office. This is, you know, George W. running around going, you know, we got to invade Iraq to show the Middle East how democracy works. George, why don't you tell your relatives? I mean, this is the royal family, the House of Saud, and the Bin Laden family. These two families are the largest patrons of the Bush family, and have been for three decades. We're talking over $1 billion in wealth has been transferred directly from Saudi Arabia into interests related to the Bush family. Mostly to, you know, the elder Bush, but a lot to the younger Bush. He was bailed out when his little oil company went broke by Osama bin Laden's brother. So, I mean, this is a little wacky here, right? And so in Saudi Arabia, you know, the point made, which is awash in oil, it's a sea of oil, and they're getting more and more of our money. They say, we don't need no stinking democracy here. Well, of course not. They got all kinds of oil. They got all kinds of money. They can, the same with Syria, the same with Iran. They can oppress their people. They can afford to. They don't have to answer to the people. They don't have to worry about popular uprisings. They don't have to deal with real issues. They've got enough money to buy enough weapons. You know, in 1999, this is the back to the point that I think it was Christoph made. In 89, oil prices slumped. Arab states cut off Jordan's subsidies. What did Jordan do? It immediately largely democratized its country. I mean, it's still a kingdom. But they opened up their economy, the King Abdullah II's all kinds of reforms. Now their economy is growing at 7% annually. Every school has computers and broadband internet links. In fact, they even said if anybody wants to become a preacher in a mosque, they first have to get a bachelor's degree in something other than religion, so that you won't end up with the mosques being run by losers. But rabble rousers who couldn't, you know, didn't have another thought in their head other than using religion as the way to get ahead in the world. Jordan's planning minister Bassem Awadella says we had to go through a crisis to accept the need for reform. So how can we provoke a crisis for Saudi Arabia that might cause them to reform? Stop buying their oil. Stop propping up their government. Well, some would say, that's what Osama bin Laden demanded you do, that and pulling your troops out of Saudi Arabia. So you'd just be giving in to Osama bin Laden back in 98 when he declared war on America. He said you better get your troops out of Saudi Arabia and you better quit buying oil from the Saudi royal family at those ridiculously low prices. Well, Bush has already pulled our troops out of Saudi Arabia, so we got half of it. And it just makes... And bin Laden thinks that oil should be $200 a barrel, by the way. And who knows? The way that it's going right now, it was above 54 last night. Price of gold's over $420 this morning. The paper, 421. What you're seeing is the rapid collapse of the United States dollar as a result of Bush's economic policies and trade policies, particularly his trade policies. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Let's just take a couple quick calls here. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan's on the line. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, first of all, the next person in line after Denny Hasper would be the president pro tem of the Senate, who at this point is Ted Stevens, Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska.
Okay, how is that defined? Doesn't that rotate every...
Well, what it is, it's the longest-serving member of the majority party, which in this case would be Stevens, since he's a Republican.
I see.
Republicans have a one-seat advantage, and he's in his 80s. I don't know how long he's been there. If the Democrats take over again, it would be Robert Byrd.
Yeah.
And I have to honestly believe that, these two guys, Hastert and Stevens, maybe no prizes, but they'd have to be better than Bush and Cheney, who I think are absolute criminals. I heard you respond when I just turned on today. I guess somebody was calling in and saying something about charging Bush and Cheney if they're voted out.
Yeah. Somebody in the last hour had called,
I actually believe this would not be payback. I believe, just like in the case of Nixon, you know, when Nixon pardoned Ford, albeit before a trial, I'd be perfectly willing for Kerry to pardon Bush and Cheney, but I think these two men should be tried. And I also think that they would probably be guilty of international crimes, because invading a country without cause, I believe, is a violation of international law. And this is kind of off the topic, but you know who Christopher Hitchens is, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Well, you know, he's talking about how Henry Kissinger ought to be charged with war crimes.
Yeah, and has been, in fact, actually, in Europe. I mean, that's one of the reasons that we pulled out of the international
criminal court,
right, was to protect Henry Kissinger.
But then how does Hitchens, how does he come off as a supporter of Bush and Cheney in this war against Iraq?
Well, he's a little schizophrenic. I mean, you know, Christopher Hitchens was traditionally sort of a wide-angle liberal, you know.
You know what he really was? He was a Stalinist, and I believe a Stalinist can go either far left or far right, and apparently he's in his far right mode right now.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I have to say I read part of his book, his Letters to a Young Man book, and thought it was excruciatingly boring.
Intelligent man, but right, he's kind of schizophrenic, because if you want to charge Kissinger, fine, you know, even though I think Kissinger was probably just doing what Nixon or Ford wanted him to, but you know, let's apply that same standard to what Bush and Cheney are doing in violation of international law.
Yeah, and should you go after Rice? I mean, a lot of people saw Kissinger as the Dr. Strangelove behind it all, and would say that Nixon and Ford were doing what Kissinger wanted. But in any case, yeah. And speaking of international crimes, I mean, here we have now Human Rights Watch, which is, you know, no slouch organization. Just today... actually, it was published yesterday by the Associated Press. This is the AP story. At least 11 al-Qaeda suspects have disappeared in U.S. custody, and some may have been tortured, Human Rights Watch said in a report issued Monday. In refusing to disclose the prisoners' whereabouts or acknowledge the detentions, Human Rights Watch said, the U.S. government has violated international laws, international treaties, and the Geneva Convention. The Reed Brody, special counsel to Human Rights Watch, said, I think the U.S. demeans itself when it adopts the philosophy that the ends justify the means in the fight against terrorism. This is just exactly what you're pointing out. We have already broken international law.
By the way, are there going to be U.N. observers for this election, you know?
For which election?
For ours.
Oh, for ours. I don't believe so.
Well, I think they wanted to do so, and Bush said it was okay.
Oh, well... You know,
I think there should be.
Yeah, I absolutely think there should be. I think the Carter Center should be sending people down to Florida. I'm pretty sure, though, that Florida has said no to observe. But I may be wrong. I'll look for that. I'll try and track it down. Yeah. Yeah, I'll see what we can find out. Rick, thanks for the call. This is the beginning. I mean, remember Pastor Nehemiah's famous note. You know, first they came for the trade unionists, and I was not a trade unionist, and then they came for the communists, and I was not a communist, and then they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, and then they came for me, or whatever the list was, I forget, but first they came for the terrorists. 20 minutes past the hour.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
Bonjour, my name is Michel, and I founded the Organic Wine Company with my sister 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines yet, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious that when turned into wine, you can really taste the difference. Our wines are delicious and eco-friendly, so I want to make it very easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organic French wines at half their regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. C'est magnifique. And if you don't agree, I will gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE, which is E-C-O-W-I-N-E. Au revoir.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.com.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Bush administration can't seem to get it right when it comes to creating jobs. In the U.S. is a net loss of jobs. In Iraq, the Bush administration blames a clerical error for overstating the number of Iraqi jobs in projects funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development. The agency first said more than 88,000 were working in its projects as of September 15th, but that has changed to just under 46,000 blamed on the clerical error.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Don't give up, you got a reason to live.
Yeah, don't give up, we've only got 21 days to go before regime change begins. I have a feeling it's going to be major. It is just absolutely going to be major. I have had so many people call me or email me in the last week. I mean, people I know here in the People's Republic of Vermont, local folks, some who know me, some who acquaintances or whatever, asking me if I would be willing to go out and canvass, if I wanted to make phone calls, if I would contribute some money to the Democratic Party to one of these campaigns. You know, just the level of activism that I am on the receiving end here, and it's not because I'm doing a talk show. It's just, you know, I mean, I'm just on the lists, right? I'm a citizen. The level of activism that I'm seeing is nothing like anything I've seen in my life before. I mean, it's it reminds me in some ways, frankly, of 64 and 68. Those 2 years seem to me, 72 to some extent, but 64 and 68 seemed like really politically intense years. Now, I was a teenager in those years, and so, you know, maybe my perspective is skewed. Maybe it was just personally intense. But anyhow, it seems like this is just a really, really, really hot year. And I don't know how intense it is happening on the right. I have a feeling that when Bush last week said that if he's elected, he's going to nominate a Supreme Court justice who will overturn Roe v. Wade. I have a feeling that got him another half a million, you know, people out there banging on doors and knocking on the streets, because the anti-abortion activists are very, very, passionate true believers. When he said he would not appoint somebody to the court who would ratify Dred Scott, as somebody pointed out to me here yesterday, I believe it was, or the day before. It must have been yesterday, given as today is Tuesday. Dred Scott is code among the anti-abortion folks for Roe v. Wade. And, in fact, I'll get into some more detail on that in a little bit. But, anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in New Mexico is on the line. Hey, Scott, you've been patiently waiting. Thank you.
Hey, Tom, you're welcome. Always happy to wait, but I always get overwhelmed at the different things I want to talk about every time you open your mouth.
Okay. But, well, that's good.
Yeah, I wanted to, a couple of things very quickly. We're just looking in the, I'm calling from New Mexico, looking in the paper the other day. My wife is down at Kerry headquarters, and what she does is she gets the rolls from the clerk's office, whoever does it, and then she enters them in for early voting. A couple of things on that. You were talking about how hot the election is. I think in a very small state, I think we've got about 2 million people here, they're talking about something like 70,000 newly registered voters.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of them either Democrat or independent, not seeing a lot of newly registered Republicans.
Well, this is why the Republicans in state after state around the United States are involved in voter suppression drives. They had, you know, they had some con on Lou Dobbs last night talking about, well, we've got to be very careful about, no, we don't have any voter fraud. We need to have people show ID when they show up. So if you forgot to bring your driver's license, you know, somebody, you know, if you went with somebody else, you can't vote. That kind of thing. And
that was the other point I wanted to bring up, which was there was a lot of this kind of activism going on in 2000 in Florida, and there is a tremendous cover article in this month's Vanity Fair. It's just an enormous article. It would be wonderful to have some of those guys on. And people talk about, you know, I personally registered 26,000 students. None of them made it onto the rolls.
Wow.
And the shenanigans afterwards are, it's an incredible piece. And there's one last thing I want to let you know about. You were talking about Saudi Arabia. And this is from Harper's Index this month. Number of foreigners beheaded by terrorist groups in Saudi Arabia since 2003. 1. Number of criminals beheaded by the Saudi government during that same time, 50.
Yeah, we're going to start on Friday, so I'm going to start saying, you know, it's Friday, it's the day for the Saudi beheading, so please go down to the soccer stadium. And for our listeners in Saudi Arabia and everybody else, say it's, you know. Anyhow, Chris, thanks for the, or Scott, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894. 29 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
A must read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Contrary to their own current statistics, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is setting a guideline that says the term underrepresented can no longer be used to describe women and minorities in the workforce. The new guidelines, being set by the Bush administration and enforced by the commission, instructs managers at federal agencies to de-emphasize the statistical makeup of their staff when reaching out for new hires and considering promotions. The directive goes against commission statistics that say white males comprise 44% of the federal workforce. 26% are white females, 8% African American men, and 10% African American women. Hispanic men and women make up the remaining 6%. And at the senior paid level, 84% of the employees are white men. The commission says that the new directives will encourage managers to look beyond race and sex and look harder at the flaws of applicants. The NAACP is calling the new directives a retreat from the spirit of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
The Economic Policy Institute says George W. Bush is way off his prediction that his tax cuts would create 300,000 jobs a month. In September, just 96,000 were created. EPI's Lee Price says 150,000 are needed just to keep up with new people entering the workforce.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month. from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
EPI says jobs declined by 200,000 in September, and the official 5.4% jobless rate paints too rosy a picture. Since October of 2002, more than a fifth of workers have been jobless for at least 6 months. That is the most over that long a time since 1948.
Undeterred by rocketing global oil prices and a lockout implemented by their company, Norwegian oil workers are stepping up their three-month-long strike. 80 workers walked off the job yesterday, joining 600 others that have already walked off or have been locked out. The third-largest oil exporter has watched production drop by 2% since the strike started in July, and experts agree it will only get worse as the two sides try to stare each other down. The oil workers walked off, demanding better working conditions from the Norwegian Shipowners Association. The company responded in September by locking out 200 additional workers. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Call centers have the highest turnover rates in this nation. The rate is 33%. That is 10% higher than the average job, according to Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Call center workers often find themselves in dreary working conditions where they are constantly monitored by employers and have to deal with abusive callers. Not to be mistaken for telemarketers, call center workers field calls for everything from prescription drug hotlines to setting up an installation date for the cable guy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 26 and a half minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here back with you. I want to get into this bizarre rewriting of American history that Antonin Scalia and George Bush and Clarence Thomas are engaged in. It is absolutely mind-boggling. These guys are coming out and telling us, Scalia was here in Vermont the night, last Friday night, the night of the debates. And as George Bush was saying that he would not appoint somebody to the Supreme Court who would rule in favor of the Dred Scott decision, which denied rights to African Americans back in 1857. And really what he was saying was he would not put somebody on the court who would rule in favor of Roe v. Wade, which the anti-abortion folks believe put the rights of women over the rights of fetuses, the right to life of a fetus. The privacy rights of women over the right to life of a fetus. I mean, this is where the right to life movement got its name from, is equating Dred Scott with Roe v. Wade. And these guys are saying that we don't have rights. They are given to us by our government. They are absolutely wrong in that. Absolutely wrong in that. The Declaration of Independence essentially opens, and it's not the first sentence, it's the second paragraph, but we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. We don't even get our rights from the Constitution. I have to share more with you about this. This is, I suspect a lot of people don't know what, for example, Alexander Hamilton or James Madison had to say about this. And it's really shocking what they thought and what Jefferson thought might happen, which is happening right now. Let me pick off a couple calls here first and just, I don't mean that dismissively. Kate, it's great to hear from you in Arcata, California, the great city that voted to impeach Bush. Congratulations.
Right. Let's hope it sets an example, at least, of what we hope might be able to happen in the election. By means of election, I should say. Anyway, to my question, I want to use myself as a bit of a guinea pig here to reveal my ignorance and have you enlighten me and maybe other people in the process. It occurred to me when you were talking about getting people out to vote, I noticed myself having this thought, what does it matter if I help get out the vote? Because the popular vote doesn't matter. And I'm in California, and our state isn't even counted. So why should I go help get out the vote, wouldn't it just be a waste of my time?
Well, there's a whole bunch of different reasons, Kate. First of all, if you're talking about the vote for president, is that what you're talking about? Okay. The vote for president does matter. It's the fact that, for example, in the last election, the fact that Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush, even though George W. Bush is sitting in the White House,
right,
has caused everyone to realize that this guy really doesn't have a mandate. And put a crimp on his style, at least until 9/11, a significant one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, number one, it's important for your voice to be heard, even if you're not necessarily going to send electors. But secondly, even, you know, the presidency is important, but much more important, frankly, is who's sitting in the House of Representatives and the Senate at both the federal and the state levels.
Right. I was thinking more in terms of the presidency. I do know that about the House and Senate, and that's really, I hadn't even connected the two in my... You know, I wanted to get out there in the last few weeks and help, but I actually had those thoughts. What does it really matter? But
yeah.
So in terms of the presidency, I see that's really informative. And then in terms also of, I mean, just to get other people in the houses of representatives in.
Yeah, you want to get good progressive people in there. You know, whether it's the Democrats or the Greens or whatever, you want to get, you know, or even occasionally there's a good Republican. I mean, last time around. 2000 in 2002, which year was it? I think it was 2000. I voted for a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
I voted for Jim Jeffords. He's my senator, and he's a good senator. He's a decent guy, and he was a Republican at the time that I voted for him. I mean, he very quickly figured out what George Bush was up to and said, "That's it. I'm out of this party." But you know, here I am. I voted for a Republican, and I voted for an independent. I voted for Bernie Sanders, and I voted for a Democrat. I voted for. What's his name? our other senator.
Can't help you there.
Yeah.
But that's really helpful, too, because I'm feeling a little freaked out and afraid, and so I think I got a little bit myopic, just thinking, oh, it's only about the presidency, but that really helps to
yeah. Now, there is, tell there,
us, keep the whole picture in mind.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot to run for politics, and in my experience is that people running for politics these days are either crazed, I mean, they're like, you know, nutso, or they're really decent people who want to make a change. And if you can filter that and find those decent people that want to make a change, a positive change in this country, you know, who really believe in what they're talking about, they're worth the effort of going to the polls for.
Right, and that's where democracy really is still alive.
Absolutely.
In that effort.
And particularly at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
At the local level. I mean, even your county commissioners and things. I mean, educate yourself about those races too, because that's the incubator for the state and national levels. So
excellent.
Pay attention.
Yeah, really excellent. Thanks, Tom.
Okay, thanks for the call, Kate.
Mm-hmm.
Great to hear
Bye-bye.
From you. Chuck in Los Angeles. Oh, we've got Victoria Jones with a report from Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
I've got a couple of other calls here. I'm sure they can hold. What's up in Washington?
Well, as you know, I'm sure you've been talking about it, Congress is wrapping up or has wrapped up. Senate passed this huge $136 billion corporate tax package.
Yeah, corporate tax giveaway.
Right. You could certainly say that, and I think some would. As you know, Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana threatened a filibuster. It all got quite exciting because she said she's going to stand up for 4 days. And I have to say, you know, I'm very prosaic. I have visions of what do you do about going to the bathroom if it's 4 days?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Senate will allow you to do that. They're very genteel.
Well, they would really have to. But that would have been quite fun to see.
No, it's been done in the past. Yeah, it's been done in the past.
It didn't happen.
Yeah. You have bathroom breaks.
That's fair.
Yeah.
You know,
and food breaks, for that matter.
Be fair.
Yeah.
Particularly since a lot of those are really old guys, you know.
Yeah.
Just couldn't do it.
Strom Thurmond used to do that stuff. I mean, back in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, I know. That was the fun time.
Yeah.
I'd love to see one.
Yep. It's now they do it kind of by proxy. They say we're gonna filibuster, and everybody says okay, don't bother. You know, we'll just pretend you did.
Yeah, and it's not quite the same.
Yeah.
But anyway, so she nearly did, but she didn't, and so that happened. And Congress goes back now, as you know, to be reelected if it possibly can, to raise money and to keep their jobs. And as you were talking about, you know, some of them are really good, and some of them could go out and join the unemployment line.
And some of them are Tom DeLay. Yeah. Well, let's...
Yeah, some will.
Yeah, let's hope.
Of course, the main thing really that's going on in Washington is everybody gearing up for tomorrow night's debate.
Yeah.
You know, people positioning themselves, jockeying, and really spinning, doing pre-debate spin, even before the post-debate spin, in terms of expectations and who's going to do what and who needs to do what. That really has become very much the focus in the last couple of days.
Yeah, okay. Great.
And I would say, you know, Iraq, which and things that are going on in Iraq, which, you know, there's really been pretty important things and some very tragic things going on in Iraq. It isn't being talked about, but I would expect in tomorrow night's debate that one or both candidates will break the rules and will bring in foreign issues. I expect that to happen.
You know what I found particularly ironic? I came across a quote this morning from George W. Bush back during when he was campaigning in 2000, and he had said that what he disliked about the Vietnam War was that it was being run by the politicians. They were making decisions about when to do things, and they were calling the timing based on politics. And he said, that's wrong. You should let the military do whatever it has to do and let it do it on its own timetable, and there should be no political considerations. And then yesterday, the White House ordered the military in Iraq to not go ahead with the attack on Fallujah and the some 30 other cities that have now fallen into the hands of insurgents until after November 2nd.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I also noticed in the previous debate when he was talking about Iraq, and he was talking about how he asked the generals what they wanted, and he asked them what he could do, and were things going as they wanted, and he was naming them and basically was saying, if anything's gone wrong with this war, it's not my fault, it's theirs because I asked them.
Yeah, well, nothing.
That was the message.
Yeah, nothing's his fault ever. I mean, it hasn't been his whole entire life. So anyway, Victoria, thank you so much for the report today from Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
From the Talk Radio News Service. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay.
Yes,
thank
indeed.
You. Okay. Bye now. It's 17 minutes before the hour. Let's go to Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico. Hey, Chuck. What's up?
Hey there. Two things on a filibuster.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate rules, I believe, have not been changed. And
no, but the protocol
basically
has.
Basically, concede the floor to a colleague.
Yeah, yeah.
So they sort of like tag team.
Right, yeah, and that's how they do it. But also what they've been doing with regard to filibusters, and there's a technical term for this, and I forget what it is, but this was explained to me once earlier, maybe last year it must have been. Now they've got this thing where basically they say, we're calling a filibuster, and then you just don't have to do it. They just collapse time. They say, okay, let's pretend 4 days have gone by. And
from my representative, they call it a pseudo-buster.
Yeah, something like that.
But
yeah.
The reason that I called is that about voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
I topped out at managing to register 56 people.
That's great.
And, I was personally proud of myself. But I made a lot of phone calls to people just recently in the last day, and anybody who's out there doing registration should follow up to make sure that they have been mailed their registration card.
Okay, good.
Because if you don't, anything can happen. And if you do, you still have a few days to get down to the county registrar or wherever you go and make sure that you get your card, because anything can happen.
There you go. Well said, Chuck. Thanks for the call. Dave in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Dave, Humboldt County, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for the Mae West thing, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
That was great.
That does bring to mind an idea, though, if we could get the frequency.
Yeah, if you just knew the frequency of the earphone that George W. is wearing, boy, could you have fun.
I mean, we could put some even dumber thoughts in his head. But
yeah.
The reason I called is this Sinclair Broadcasting, they just maybe have this backfire on themselves. As best I'm able to ascertain here, pretty much the overwhelming majority of the world opinion and U.S. opinion is that Vietnam War was a bad mistake.
Yeah, the problem is that that's not the way that they're spinning the documentary. The way that they're spinning the documentary is not about the fact that Kerry opposed the war. It's they're basically massively taking out of context this speech that he gave in before Congress. It wasn't a speech, a presentation, whatever. You know, when he testified before Congress, his testimony. After he held what are called the Winter Soldier hearings. And they had these hearings in Detroit, and 150 guys got up and said that they had personally committed war crimes. And Kerry was simply describing that, you know, what they said. And he did it in the context of this is an indictment of of the policy of the politicians, of Richard Nixon, of LBJ. This is an indictment of them, not an indictment, of the soldiers. And And they have completely taken it out of context. They've dropped the first few words where he said, you know, I just came back. I think I may have that. Let me just see.
Months ago in Detroit.
Yeah, here it is. I just share this with you.
Months ago in Detroit, we had an investigation at which over 150 honorably discharged and many very highly decorated veterans testified to war crimes committed in Southeast Asia. Not isolated incidents, but crimes committed on a day-to-day basis with the full awareness of officers at all levels of command. It's impossible to describe to you exactly what did happen in Detroit, the emotions in the room, the feelings of the men who were reliving their experiences in Vietnam. But they did. They relived the absolute horror of what this country, in a sense, made them do.
And then he goes through the details of it, which you've heard ad nauseum on the Swiftboat ads.
I'm
and then
sure
he wraps
you're going to try to
the term Winter Soldier is a play
and
then, on words.
Yeah, and then he wraps it up with this.
The term Winter Soldier is a play on words of Thomas Paine's in 1776 when he spoke of the sunshine patriot and summertime soldiers who deserted at Valley Forge because the going was rough. And we who've come here to Washington have come here because we feel we have to be winter soldiers now. We could come back to this country and we could be quiet. We could hold our silence. We could not tell what went on in Vietnam. But we feel because of what threatens this country, the fact that the crimes threaten it, not Reds and not Redcoats, but the crimes which we're committing are what threaten it. And we have to speak out.
And, you know, I thought that that was an act of incredible courage. Yeah. But they are going to say in this documentary that he was saying that all Vietnam veterans are guilty of these crimes. And of course, he never said that. In fact, he went out of his way to not say that. In fact, to say the opposite, Vietnam veterans were actually the victims of the war as much as the people in Vietnam were.
Well, they just started, Tom, we'll count on you to try to point that out.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, TV has incredible reach, and this is the largest owner of television stations in the United States, you know, in the hands of a single corporation, and, you know, it's going to be a tough one. Anyhow, Dave, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. And, you know, I want to get back to this thing of rights. Do we have rights? Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist Number 84, there was this agitation for a Bill of Rights. You know, we ought to have a Bill of Rights in the Constitution. There was no Bill of Rights the first couple of years of the Constitution. It was ratified in, it was presented in 1787. I think it was ratified in 88. And the Bill of Rights wasn't appended, as I recall, until 1789. And so, you know, for a year or two, there was no Bill of Rights. And he was saying, you know, we don't need one. He said, here's the quote. He said, it has been remarked several times, truly remarked, the Bills of Rights are, in their origin, stipulations between kings and their subjects. And he says, you know, this isn't a kingdom. He says, we the people created this government, and therefore we the people hold all the rights. Here in the United States, in strictness, the people surrender nothing, and as they retain everything, they have no need of particular reservations of rights. And see, the rights are ours. Well, tell that to Scalia or Bush. 10 minutes before the hour. Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
In the foreword to Tom Hartman's book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, renowned author Joseph Chilton Pierce writes,
to discover brilliant, innovative, creative, and original thinking is one of life's rare privileges.
To discover that such a thinker has focused on the most critical of all issues facing our species is encouraging. Because The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight is a seminal work offering a viewpoint original yet ancient, I see our situation today in a new light. And because of the scope and depth of this work, I find it inspiring as well as disturbing. I rather exhausted superlative in praise of Tom Hartman's book, The Prophet's Way, which I rightly called the most important book I've ever read. But now I find this sequel calling for equal praise, since the issue here addresses the whole of our species, and indeed all species.
The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late by Tom Hartman, in bookstores everywhere.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. No end in sight to work stoppage for thousands of San Francisco hotel workers. This week, hotel managers announced they'll keep employees locked out indefinitely. Over 1,400 workers at four downtown San Francisco hotels went on strike last week, vowing not to return to work for 2 weeks or until they receive a fair labor contract. In response, the San Francisco Hotel Multi-Employer Group locked out 2,600 non-striking workers at 10 other hotels.
Well, they're playing hardball because they're global corporations and they're used to getting their way, and they aren't used to having to sit down as equals across the bargaining table from people.
Mike Casey, president of Unite Here Local 2, said workers are attempting to protect their health and pension benefits, reduce workloads, and gain wage increases, despite fierce resistance from management.
We are not going to stand and bow to their hardball, heavy-handed tactics. We're not going to be intimidated by their approach here, and if they want to come back and bargain respectfully with us, then hopefully we'll get a deal down. But if they want to go at it with us and start this fight, then we'll show them, you know, what we're made of.
In a press call, John Wilhelm, president of the Unite Here Hospitality Division, said they're seeking a 2-year deal to line up contract negotiations with the bulk of other major union hotel cities, including New York, Chicago, Toronto, Honolulu, and Boston.
If we're going to have effective bargaining in each of the hotel markets, we've got to figure out how to have a national dialogue on the issues that are the most important.
10,000 Unite Here casino employees in Atlantic City are also on strike, and Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. may soon join them if current negotiations fail. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
15, there's still time for you. Time to buy and time to lose. 15.
And welcome back. Perhaps there may be, to a certain degree, wrote James Madison in 1787 to Thomas Jefferson. Now here, let me set this up. Madison had sent to Jefferson. Jefferson was in Paris. Madison was in Washington, D.C., or in Philadelphia. And they had just written the Constitution, and Madison sends it to Jefferson. And Jefferson reads it over and says, my problem with this thing is it's got no Bill of Rights. And Madison says back, we don't need a Bill of Rights. The entire thing is a Bill of Rights. To quote Alexander Hamilton from the Federalist No. 87, the entire Constitution is a Bill of Rights. In the preamble, it says, we the people. do ordain this Constitution. In other words, the rights do not come from the government. They come from us. We hold the power here. So we don't need a Bill of Rights because we hold all the rights. And Jefferson says, yes, but the day may come when you've got politicians, you know, when you've got a generation that has forgotten what we all knew, what we fought and died for. And should that day come, there must be an explicit laying out of rights in the Declaration of Independence so that they don't forget. And Madison says, okay, perhaps there may be a certain degree of danger that a succession of artful and ambitious rulers may by gradual and well-timed advances finally erect an independent government on the subversion of liberty. Should this danger exist at all, it is prudent to guard against it, especially when the precaution can do no injury. In other words, he says, okay, I'll go along with you. But then in the next sentence he says, at the same time, I must own that I see no tendency in our governments to danger on that side. In other words, it's not going to happen here, Mr. Jefferson. Don't worry. You know, we're never going to, you know, slide into tyranny. We will never have people who, in our government, who don't realize that rights are, you know, as they said, given by the Creator, that they come with the package of being a person. And then, of course, we've got the great quote from Clarence Thomas in the Texas sodomy case, and I quote, I can find neither in the Bill of Rights nor in any other part of the Constitution a general right of privacy. Well, that's because they didn't feel like they needed to spell it out, Mr. Thomas, although you read the Fourth Amendment again. I mean, they got awful close to it. But then you got, you know, all the right-wingers saying the same thing. Why? Because they want to overturn Roe v. Wade. Very simple. And because they want to say, you know, the Patriot Act, sneak and peek, you don't have any right to privacy anyway. You know that corporation that says you've got to give your Social Security? Yeah, you didn't have any right to privacy anyway. I mean, what are you complaining about? Come on. You're lucky you got any privacy at all. That's the conservative agenda. That's, the, you know, Rush Limbaugh on his show saying there is no general right to privacy in the Constitution. Nonsense. The right to privacy comes with being a human being. It's just that simple. At least in the United States that I knew and hope to know again.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Now, it's time for This Billionaire Moment.
The recent handover of power back to the Iraqis has got investors worried. They ask, what about our war profiteering? Will we still be able to privatize everything in sight? Darlings, everything is under control because everything is still under our control. Alawi has been a wonderful CIA asset for years. Ambassador John Negroponte cut his teeth working with death squads out of Honduras in the 80s, and 140,000 American troops are protecting our oil as we pump it out from under their soil. We won't let this business bonanza be ruined by the evils of accountability or democracy. So relax. We know what we're doing. I'm Zena Fogg for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
Here come the billion...
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Contrary to their own current statistics, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is setting a guideline that says the term underrepresented can no longer be used to describe women and minorities in the workforce. The new guidelines, being set by the Bush administration and enforced by the commission, instructs managers at federal agencies to de-emphasize the statistical makeup of their staff when reaching out for new hires and considering promotions. The directive goes against commission statistics that say white males comprise 44% of the federal workforce, 26% are white females, 8% African American men, and 10% African American women. Hispanic men and women make up the remaining 6%. And at the senior pay level, 84% of the employees are white men. The commission says that the new directives will encourage managers to look beyond race and sex and look harder at the flaws of applicants. The NAACP is calling the new directives a retreat from the spirit of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
The Economic Policy Institute says George W. Bush is way off his prediction that his tax cuts would create 300,000 jobs a month. In September, just 96,000 were created. EPI's Lee Price says 150,000 are needed just to keep up with new people entering the workforce.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
EPI says jobs declined by 200,000 in September, and the official 5.4% jobless rate paints too rosy a picture. Since October of 2002, more than a fifth of workers have been jobless for at least 6 months. That is the most over that long a time since 1948.
Undeterred by rocketing global oil prices and a lockout implemented by their company, Norwegian oil workers are stepping up their three-month-long strike. 80 workers walked off the job yesterday, joining 600 others that have already walked off or have been locked out. The third-largest oil exporter has watched production drop by 2% since the strike started in July, and experts agree it will only get worse as the two sides try to stare each other down. The oil workers walked off demanding better working conditions from the Norwegian Shipowners Association. The company responded in September by locking out 200 additional workers. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Call centers have the highest turnover rates in this nation. The rate is 33%. That is 10% higher than the average job, according to Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Call center workers often find themselves in dreary working conditions where they are constantly monitored by employers and have to deal with abusive callers. Not to be mistaken for telemarketers, call center workers field calls for everything from prescription drug hotlines to setting up an installation date for the cable guy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
So, Jasper, how was your year?
Excellent. This administration gives the best returns ever.
Do tell.
Well, the money I paid to a lobbying firm in Washington brought in over $50 million in overseas contracts.
Oh, yes, lobbying pays.
Are you still into commodities, Max?
No, I'm funding politicians. My campaign contributions got me over $100 million worth of regulation waivers.
Well done, Max.
Today's wisest investments are in politics. Where are you throwing your money?
Easily paid for by billionairesforbush.com.
In foreign policy, it's hard to claim the moral high road when you're stumbling down the low road arm in arm with repressive dictators. Yet there's our boy George W. insisting to the United Nations in a recent speech that his Iraqi adventure is all about his deep commitment to spreading democracy throughout the world. While he hugs up to Pervez Musharraf, the anti-democratic general who seized power in Pakistan 5 years ago in a military coup. Bush calls Musharraf a trusted buddy in his global war on terrorism, apparently oblivious to the fact that the general himself is considered a terror by Pakistan's democracy advocates. The very next day after his pious democracy speech to the UN, George met with Musharraf for an hour in the White House. Yet our prez ducked mentioning an unpleasant matter of major political importance in Pakistan. Not only has Musharraf declared himself president, but he also continues as chief of the army, thus reinforcing his autocratic military grip on the country. Earlier this year, Musharraf pledged to give up his military position, but he recently reneged, infuriating those fighting for some semblance of democracy in Pakistan. Imagine their anger that Bush, a guy claiming to be a tiger fighting for democracy, meets for an hour with this dictator without even a meow or protest about Musharraf's continuing military rule. To explain Bush's wussiness, an aide was reduced to semantical contortions, asserting that George had told the general that it's, quote, important to stay on the road of democratic reform, claiming that the general knew what George meant. This is Jim Hightower saying, oh yeah, subtlety always works with military dictators. As a result, Musharraf returned to Pakistan confident that the Bushites had given him a big old wink and would not raise a finger to oppose his ongoing dictatorship. And George wonders why he has no credibility with democracy advocates around the world.
What if I told you that you could get cash back from your federal student loans? No, really. You can receive up to $1,000 cash rebate just for making your first 6 payments on time. Introducing College Loan Corporation's Reward. Now you can save up to 50% on your monthly payments, lock in the lowest interest rates in history, and you may be able to earn a significant rebate. That's cold hard cash in your pocket. To take advantage of this amazing offer, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to four real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win at LendingTree.com. Equal housing opportunity. Some restrictions apply. See website for details and licensing.
Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 4 years ago tonight, 4 years ago, could it have been? You know, it's funny. In some ways, it seems like it was just a year or so ago, and in some ways, it seems like it was another... another lifetime. 4 years ago tonight, George W. Bush was engaged in a debate with Al Gore. It was the second presidential debate. And he was doing pretty well. He was doing very well. I think it's worth revisiting some of the things that George W. said during his debate with Al Gore, to provide a little historical context for the debate that's coming up tomorrow night. For example, here's something that he said 4 years ago to Al Gore. He said, we can help build coalitions, but we can't put our troops all around the world. Well, now, 4 years later, as Americans Coming Together points out, 4 years later, instead of helping build coalitions, Bush has put the U.S. into an Iraq war where 90% of the casualties are borne by the U.S., there have been 1,213 troops killed in the Iraq War, 1,075 of them American. That's an absolute number, 89%. Well, 4 years ago today, tonight, I mean more or less tomorrow night, you could say. This is sort of like the parallel track of the debate, right? 4 years ago tonight, George W. Bush, in debating Al Gore, said, we can lend money. But we have to do it wisely. Lend money to other countries. Well, 4 years later, you remember when John Kerry said, and this is, of course you remember, because it's been quoted so often by the Republicans, I actually voted for the $87 billion before I voted against it. The first appropriation of the $87 billion set it up as a loan to the country of Iraq from the people of the United States. We will liberate you from Saddam, but you're sitting on the second largest supply of oil on earth. Your oil wealth makes us look like pikers. You have, 10% of the world's oil supply. We don't even have that. You can pay back the cost of liberating you from this nasty guy. So the $87 billion is going to be a loan. And that went before the House and Senate, and John Kerry voted in favor of it. But the Republicans, Bush said, no, you can't do it as a loan. You got to do it as a gift. And you can't pay for it out of current revenue. You can't pay for it by increasing taxes. And this is the point Kerry keeps making, but it's funny. I don't think most people hear it. He says, the amount of the Bush tax cut for people who earn more than $200,000 that year, last year, was $89 billion. So he said, let's just roll back the tax cut for 1 year and pay for this $87 billion with it. And that way we won't be hitting our children with this bill. Because $87 billion is a pile of money. It's a substantial amount of money. I mean, a lot of people just don't get it, how much money it is. But it really is a lot of money. And Bush, of course, said, no, you can't do that. Isn't going to happen. And so, you know, we ended up with this. And so Kerry, knowing that the $87 billion was going to pass anyway, Kerry and Edwards both voted against it, not because they didn't want the $87 billion to go to the troops, but because they wanted Bush to do it right. If you're going to do it right. I mean, give us a bill that we can vote for that, you know, where it's just simply done honestly. Where, you know, it's not our grandchildren, it's not our kids that are paying for it. Where we ourselves are paying for it. The war in Iraq has so far cost the United States, as of this moment, $139,642,342,000. I'm watching the clock. You go to TomHartmann.com and click on the show homepage, and there's the clock right there. You can click on it, and you can see, you know, what does that cost really mean? Well, just the amount of money we've spent already, not the $200 billion that's been appropriated, that we're going to spend through this fiscal year, that is through this next year, until October of next year, but just the amount that we've already spent, including the billions given to Halliburton and other defense contractors. This $139,685,431,000, and on it goes, could have paid for how many children in the United States to attend a year of Head Start? How many kids do you think could have attended a year of Head Start for the amount of money that we've spent so far in Iraq? 18,501,000 children. Whoa. Well, how many kids could we have insured for a year? Give them full medical insurance, dental, eyes, everything. With the cost so far, the $139 billion that we spent so far in Iraq, we could pay for health insurance for 83,644 children for a year. 1 year in Iraq, 83 million children's insurance. No, we couldn't do that, though. That's too expensive, says George W. Well, how about hiring some public school teachers? How many school teachers could we have hired in the United States in 1 year with the amount of money, the $139,685,568,403 that we spent so far in Iraq? How many additional public school teachers could we have hired with that money? Well, my friends, it turns out we could have hired 2,420,768 public school teachers. That's, you know, the whole shooting match, National Education Association, union memberships, dues, benefits, the pension, everything. Well, you know, but what about our kids in college? I mean, we'd like to provide our students with four-year scholarships to public universities. I mean, that's really an important thing, isn't it? That's why Thomas Jefferson started the University of Virginia as a free school. Because he thought every American who was capable of attending college should be able to, regardless of their station in life. Well, with the money that we've spent so far in Iraq, not the money appropriated, which is almost twice as much, but just the money we've spent so far in Iraq, that Bush, you know, threatened to veto Kerry's suggestion that this be a loan to Iraq, the $87 billion that he voted for before the $87 billion that he voted against. Bush said, no, it's got to be a gift. With that money, with the money that we have spent so far in Iraq, we could have given four-year scholarships at public universities to 6,771,657 of our young people. Well, what about, I mean, we've got all these people living in poverty. What if we built housing units and gave them to them and said, okay, it's yours now. You better take good care of it. You can sell it. You can do whatever you want. But, you know, here's your bootstraps. Now, pull yourself up by them. Here's free housing. How many housing units could we have built for America's poor with the money that we've spent so far in Iraq? 1,257,739 units of free public housing. Well, it wouldn't even need to be free. I mean, you know, you could even charge for it and get the money back if you wanted. If you want the government to be in the landlord business, I frankly don't think that's a good idea. But what about? Well, you know, that's all very nice, you say, but you know, you're being very kind of Amero-centric, America-o-centric, just looking at what we could do in the United States. What about the fact that in the 24 hours since this time yesterday, some 54,000 people around the planet have died of starvation, 38,000 of them children? You know, you've got a lot of people dying of starvation and malnutrition. What if we wanted to feed everyone in the world who is hungry? Everybody in the world who is hungry. Could we do that with the money that we've spent so far in Iraq? Turns out, we could feed every hungry person in the world for 5 years with the money we've spent so far in Iraq. 5 years, that's... Well, that's... But we do have this AIDS problem around the world. That's killing off a lot of people, and it's also, you know, creating more virulent, resistant strains, and you know, it's a public health problem, and people with AIDS are more likely to get things like pneumonia and pass it along, and so you know, there's all these secondary public health considerations. Shouldn't we do something about the AIDS epidemic with that money that we could have spent in Iraq, or that money that you know, obviously we could lay our hands on it because we spent it in Iraq? Well, as a matter of fact, we could have fully funded the AIDS programs for the entire planet for 13 years. With the $139 billion we've spent so far in Iraq. You go, wow, that's amazing. Well, but what about, I mean, there's a lot of other diseases that are killing people, too. You know, we need to immunize children against polio and diphtheria and whooping cough and all these other diseases. We've got some great vaccine programs. You know, Bill Gates gives millions to immunization programs in the third world. With the money that we've spent so far in Iraq, how many children could we immunize in the world? Well, you could immunize all of them with the money we've spent so far in Iraq. And not just this year. You could immunize all the children in the world, not just for this year, not just for this generation, a generation being generally considered to be 20 years, not even just for the next two generations. The next 40 years, you could immunize every child in the world for the next 46 years with the money we have spent so far in Iraq. So, anyhow, back to this George Bush. We can lend money, but we have to do it wisely. Yeah, what he said in the debate a year ago tonight. Another point he made a year ago tonight, he said, I'm worried about overcommitting our military around the world. Lou Dobbs. General David Grange. General, just how overcommitted are we? How unmanned? General David Grange. I believe, Lou, that our military is quite overcommitted. He gets the understatement award for the day. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. You're in the Democracy Zone.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Waitsfield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates block out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
If it weren't for In These Times, I'd be a man without a country, says author Kurt Vonnegut. For more than 27 years, the progressive news magazine In These Times has provided groundbreaking coverage of movements for social, environmental, and economic justice. It is the publication the scholar and activist Cornel West calls the most creative and challenging news magazine of the American left. In These Times features award-winning reporting and analysis of national and international news. Turn to In These Times for stories on civil liberties, the environment, labor, feminism, and much more. Writer Barbara Ehrenreich put it this way, to people who say they are sick of the corporate-dominated and celebrity-fixated media, I say, stop whining and subscribe to In These Times. Find In These Times on your newsstand or visit us online at www.inthesetimes.com or call 1-800-827-0270. That's 1-800-827-0270.
This is what Ralph Nader has to say about embryonic stem cell research. That's right, not a word. John Kerry has vowed to lift the Bush administration's stifling restrictions, restrictions that could be cruelly delaying cures and treatments. Why the silence? Maybe Ralph Nader worries you might not like what he has to say. Or maybe he just doesn't care. The Committee for Advancement of Stem Cell Research approved this message. It was not approved by any candidate or any candidate's committee. Visit CASCR.com.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. All the attention given to Halliburton and their no-bid contract in Iraq would make you think that it is not a regular practice. But a new report from the Center of Public Integrity reveals that at least $362 billion was spent on no-bid contracts by the Pentagon since 1998. But the Pentagon did not stop there, rewarding $255 billion in cost-plus contracts that allow companies to spend as much as they deem necessary on a job, including an agreed-upon profit.
Are George Bush's policies getting you down? Have you had enough of Bush's messianic militarism? Does John Ashcroft's assault on the Bill of Rights scare you? Do you believe that Dick Cheney had his conscience surgically removed 3 decades ago? Are you angry at the Iraq fiasco that was the brainchild of Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul out of his Wolfowitz? Well, then subscribe to the Progressive Magazine. You'll get the insights of Barbara Ehrenreich, the inspiration of Howard Zinn, and the mirth of Molly Ivins, Will Durst, and Kate Clinton. They'll help you survive this dark age. And check this out. You can subscribe today for only $12 for 12 monthly issues. Simply get on the web and go to www.progressive.org or call 1-800-827-0555 and mention offer radio. That's 1-800-827-0555 and mention the radio offer from the Tom Hartman Program. That's the Progressive. It's your antidote to reactionary policies.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 24 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. George Bush, 1 year ago today. Where was he? Oh, by the way, somebody had asked, Shelby actually had asked, where did those numbers come from? If you go to TomHartman.com and you click on show homepage, the radio show homepage, you scroll down, you'll find the National Priorities Project. It's actually the war in Iraq. It's costofwar.com, actually, is their website. You'll find a link to it. You don't need to go through my website to get to it. I was thinking initially that it was a longer URL, but it isn't. It's costofwar, costofwar.com. I should have just looked up at the URL bar to begin there. That's how I got to it. I go to my own website. I can't remember that stuff that well. So anyhow, costofwar.com. So George Bush, 1 year ago tonight, he says, maybe I'm missing something here. Or did he say, maybe I'm missing something. I can't quite do Texas. I can. Maybe I'm missing something here. I mean, we're going to have kind of a nation-building corps from America? Absolutely not. Our military is meant to fight and win war. And when it gets overextended, morale drops. Well, yeah. I don't even need to comment on that.
Another quote from 4 years ago tonight. The issue of health care had come up. And Bush said, well, in fact, here's the question from the moderator. What about the more than 40 million younger Americans who do not have health insurance right now? What would you do about that? Bush. Well, I've got a plan to do something about that. It's to make health care affordable and available. This is what we thought we were getting. Now, all the good people out there who voted for George W. Bush, this is what they thought they were getting. You don't overextend your military. You don't do nation building. You do provide affordable and easily available health care. This is what people thought was going to happen. 4 years later, health insurance premiums have risen by 59%. In 4 years. I mean, 59% in 4 years. And those are driving up the cost of health care. Drug companies and the for-profit HMOs, Bill Frist's family and the hospitals, all these the for-profit companies that have been driving up the cost of health care, this 59% increase in the cost of health care, Bush has been rewarding. Now, 1% of that 59% increase was caused by medical malpractice insurance claims. Those nasty trial lawyers defending people who have been harmed by doctors or hospitals or insurance companies. 1% of it. That's the part that George wants to go after. We're going to stop them trial lawyers. We're going to take your cost of health care down 1%. Although it's gone up 59% in the 4 years that he has held office. He went on to say, I want to remind you the number of uninsured in America during their watch has increased. Talking about Bill Clinton and Al Gore. My priority is going to be the health of our citizens. These folks have had 8 years to get something done in Washington, D.C. on the uninsured. They have not done it. 4 years ago, Bush insisted that Gore be blamed for the 1.3 million Americans who became uninsured during the 8 years when Al Gore was vice president. Instead of 1.3 million becoming uninsured during 8 years, we now have 5.2 million who have become uninsured in just 3.5 years. I would say that's something worth holding him accountable for. I'm surprised that there hasn't been more media attention paid to this, frankly. Why has not anybody done, you know, pulled out the tapes of the last debates and said, you know, Mr. President, here's the positions you took. What happened? Well, he'd say, of course, 9-11. 9-11, I mean, you know, that a small drop in the bucket when you look at the total federal budget. It doesn't wash. 29 minutes past the hour.
At last, there's a positive focus on a condition that affects millions. Read The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. John Rady, author of User's Guide to the Brain, says this about The Edison Gene.
Once again, with tireless scholarship and a bit of poetry, Tom Hartman helps take us to the edge of knowing ourselves, our brains, and our world.
The Edison Gene, available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not so pop culture, democracy and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
And I'm Doug Cunningham.
Contrary to their own current statistics, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is setting a guideline that says the term underrepresented can no longer be used to describe women and minorities in the workforce. The new guidelines, being set by the Bush administration and enforced by the commission, instructs managers at federal agencies to de-emphasize the statistical makeup of their staff when reaching out for new hires and considering promotions. The directive goes against commission statistics that say white males comprise 44% of the federal workforce. 26% are white females, 8% African American men, and 10% African American women. Hispanic men and women make up the remaining 6%. And at the senior paid level, 84% of the employees are white men. The commission says that the new directives will encourage managers to look beyond race and sex and look harder at the flaws of applicants. The NAACP is calling the new directives a retreat from the spirit of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
The Economic Policy Institute says George W. Bush is way off his prediction that his tax cuts would create 300,000 jobs a month. In September, just 96,000 were created. EPI's Lee Price says 150,000 are needed just to keep up with new people entering the workforce.
We've got the numbers to expect from the Bush tax cuts. That was 306,000 jobs a month from mid-2003 to the end of 2004. So the job growth we've been getting falls far short of those benchmarks.
EPI says jobs declined by 200,000 in September, and the official 5.4% jobless rate paints too rosy a picture. Since October of 2002, more than a fifth of workers have been jobless for at least 6 months. That is the most over that long a time since 1948.
Undeterred by rocketing global oil prices and a lockout implemented by their company, Norwegian oil workers are stepping up their three-month-long strike. 80 workers walked off the job yesterday, joining 600 others that have already walked off or have been locked out. The third-largest oil exporter has watched production drop by 2% since the strike started in July, and experts agree it will only get worse as the two sides try to stare each other down. The oil workers walked off, demanding better working conditions from the Norwegian Shipowners Association. The company responded in September by locking out 200 additional workers. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Call centers have the highest turnover rates in this nation. The rate is 33%. That is 10% higher than the average job, according to Mercer Human Resource Consulting. Call center workers often find themselves in dreary working conditions where they are constantly monitored by employers and have to deal with abusive callers. Not to be mistaken for telemarketers, call center workers field calls for everything from prescription drug hotlines to setting up an installation date for the cable guy. You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 27 minutes before the hour. Condi Rice up to her 24th rationale for the war in Iraq. Started out with war on terror, then went to weapons of mass destruction. Then she said he was denying us access to the inspectors, or access to the inspectors. Then said regime change was a good plan. That was number four. Number five, that Saddam Hussein was evil. These are actual... I got nice long quotes that go with each one of these from testimony given by Condi or Rummy. Number six, actually. It'll curry favor with the Middle East. If Iraqis are dancing in the streets, as they will be when Saddam goes, then that has the potential to transform the region in our favor, said Richard Pearl. Number seven, set an example for nations that sponsor terrorism. Number eight, liberate the Iraqis. Number nine, Iraq's broken promises. First, it's clear from the Iraq regime's 11 years of defiance that containment has not led to their compliance. To the contrary, containment is breaking down. Except that containment was working. Number 10, revenge. President George W. Bush on 9-26-02. After all, it's Saddam Hussein is the guy who tried to kill my dad. Number 11, threat to the region. Number 12, because we can. Number 13, unfinished business. Mr. Richard Pearl testifying. I'm sorry, Richard Pearl on NBC's Meet the Press on October 6th.
talking about how, well, the specter of house-to-house fighting in Baghdad has been raised again, and as it was in 1991. It's one of the reasons why we failed to finish Saddam in 91, which we should have done. But you supported the president in 91, says Russert. Well, I thought it was a bad idea to stop and leave the Republican Guard in place, says Pearl, because we had them surrounded in the desert, and the sensible thing to do would have been to force the disarmament of Iraq on that equation, but we didn't do it. Number 13, for the sake of history. Yes, that's George W. Bush actually said. But for the sake of freedom, for the sake of what's right, for the sake of history, we're not going to let the world's worst leaders threaten America with the world's worst weapons. Number 15, disarmament. Number 16, a commitment to our children. Number 17, imminent threat. Number 18, preserve the peace. Number 19, threat to freedom. This is from the president's address to the UN General Assembly on September 12, 2002. Number 20, link to Al-Qaeda. Number 21, Iraq is unique. Number 22, relevance to the United Nations, or of the United Nations. If the UN is going to be relevant, you know, they've got to go along with it. Number 23, international law. He has demonstrated time and time again his aggressive intent. What is not arguable is that he's in violation of international law. It's Colin Powell. 24, Sunday's latest, Saddam had an insatiable appetite for weapons of mass destruction. How you can have an insatiable appetite for something you don't have is a bit of a challenge, I suppose. But that's the quote that came out of the administration. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Our website, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into the chat room and say hi, full of folks, some of the finest minds on the entire Internet, guaranteed, or your money back. No, there's no cost. What is this? Bing. No, of course it's free. 1-866-889-8894. Brian in New Jersey is on the line. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Appetite for Weapons of Mass Destruction. Is that Guns N' Roses' new album, Tom?
I'm not sure.
I have a question. Bush keeps saying that Kerry missed over 200 votes in the Senate. Is this significant? Did he really miss over 200 votes? I mean, what does that number really mean? I'll just hang up and let you answer.
Thanks, yeah.
Tom.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Brian. I don't have a clue to give you the answer straight up. I know that they've been fiddling with these numbers. You know, that for example, John Edwards served as president of the Senate, filled in. There's this rotational thing where you know somebody actually bangs the gavel and convenes the Senate. He's done that twice in the last 4 years. Dick Cheney's only done it once. So, you know, Cheney's saying, well, I haven't seen you in the Senate. Where was Cheney? Well, he was having lunch with Republicans on Tuesdays, but never Democrats. So there's that. There's the argument that they were making that in some of the earlier deceptive ads that Kerry and Edwards had missed some very large percentage of public Intelligence Committee hearings. What they failed to note was that the private ones, which is where the real business gets done, where the real stuff is happening, their attendance was actually quite good. The public ones were the ones, you know, the ones where you knew in advance what it was going to happen, you knew what the agenda was, there was testimony, you could read it later, you really didn't need to be there. And a lot of people skip, you know, the public meetings. The private ones, they make it a point to show for. But in terms of their attendance right now, frankly, I don't know. It doesn't matter to me, I got to tell you. If we were looking at attendance over over John Kerry's 20-year Senate history, it's very, very good. And if, you know, he had a long history, many years of lousy attendance, then I'd say, you know, maybe this guy isn't a very good senator. But what you have right now is somebody who's been running for president for the last year. And so I'm willing to cut him some slack. I mean, Bush himself has been on the campaign trail continuously for the last 4 years. He's spent, you know, you can make the argument, he has spent about 40% of his entire presidency either on vacation or speaking to private groups that were arguably campaign stops. So, you know, it's... You pick your statistics. 1-866-889-8894. Helen in West Virginia on the line. Hey, Helen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Well,
I don't call too often because I enjoy listening to you more.
Well, thank you.
You're very informative, and I had a few comments.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, I didn't know if you'd, you know, had discussed Senator Chafee at any time.
I haven't recently. What slipped by me here, Helen?
Well, you know, when the war started, I mean, they were questioning him on TV, and he said that they were going to, about the resolution, that they were going to go ahead with it anyway.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a Republican senator from Rhode Island, and I was astonished, you know.
Yeah.
And then they had him on the other day, and he made comment he was going to write in a different Republican.
Yeah, Lincoln Chafee, I think, is feeling that he's been badly burned.
I think he has, and he seems like a pretty nice guy, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, not because he's not for Bush, but he sees all the problems.
Yeah, I think he's a decent man. He's not one of these guys, you know, like Tom DeLay, who it's baseball. You know, it's my team, right or wrong,
right.
You know, that sort of thing.
Right, and there's something else I wanted to mention pertaining to these flu shots.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we listened to him in the debate, our president, and commenting on how they have to make sure that they're safe and everything about the prescription drugs over in Canada.
Right, and at that point, I'm yelling at the TV screen, where are all the dead Canadians?
Well, the whole point is, he's getting flu shots from out of the country over in the U.K.,
yeah,
and we're not
right.
allowed to get them next door in Canada. I don't understand, you know, the prescriptions
yeah.
from Canada or just flu shots from England.
Right. You know, it's funny. I didn't know that the flu shots were coming from England until, you know, a couple of weeks ago when we first started seeing the news reports that they were unavailable. I don't think most Americans had a clue that we were getting our flu. But you make a very good point. It's very ironic.
I really feel people ought to consider thinking about that, especially if it's brought up tomorrow night. And I am for this stem cell research.
Yeah.
And I wish John Kerry all the luck in the world. God
yeah.
bless him.
Me too. Amen.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Helen. Thanks for calling. Good to hear from you. And this issue of health care is one that is really, really a critical issue. And on this, I am far more, I don't know what the word is. I suppose folks on the right would say liberal than John Kerry. Some may even say radical. I personally would say rational. See, here's the way I think of this. There are some things that it's just fine if you want to make a profit on, you know, doing. Like, you know, we want entrepreneurs out there. We want people making clothing. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to make a profit making clothes, cool. We're all in favor of that. If you want to make a profit making computers, that's fine. That's a marvelous thing. You want to make a profit making telephones, you know, all of these, you know, you want to make a profit making toys or, you know, wheelchairs or baby carts or maybe not wheelchair. We'll get back to that. But if you want to make a profit, you know, in the vast majority, 99% of the realm, as it were, the commercial realm, I'm all in favor of that. It's what I've done all my life. This radio show is a business. I've run my own businesses for 30 years now. And, you know, on and off in various ways. And I'm all in favor of the entrepreneurial spirit in America. And there are a few things that we've collectively agreed over the last 230 years that it's not appropriate that people be making a profit on. For example, running the army. We all agreed we want to have an army, and we don't want to have a corporation running it. We don't want it to be run for the purpose of making money. We want it to be run for the purpose of defending the United States. That's the most important thing. So the army defends the United States. For example, police departments. We want to have police departments protecting us, but we don't want them run for the purpose of making profits. I mean, everybody can understand this. There actually was a time in America when police departments were on a for-profit basis. You've seen the old Western movies where the town would get to, you know, some of the folks in town would get together and hire the marshal. And some of the folks paid his salary, and the other folks who didn't pay his salary didn't quite get much attention from the marshal. Not quite how it played out in Matt Dillon, but, you know, some of the more authentic Westerns, you can get it. And, you know, we decided eventually, hey, you know, let's tax ourselves and pay for this. The same thing with fire departments. It was not uncommon in big cities for there to be three, four, five different for-profit fire departments, fire companies, fire corporations that operated on a for-profit basis and that competed with each other. And you would have to pick the one you wanted, and they would give you a medallion to put on the front of your house. And if you had a fire and you called the fire station or, you know, notified them somehow, rang the bell or you know, ran down and said, hey, the house is on fire, whatever. If they drove by, if you didn't have the right medallion out front, they just kept on going, even if your house was on fire. And that happened enough times that finally people said, you know, this fire department stuff really shouldn't be for profit. There really are some things that should not be for profit. And we even decided, you know, hospitals. This is really important stuff, you know, taking care of our health. That shouldn't be for profit. And most states in the United States had laws that said if you want to run a hospital, you have to run it as a nonprofit corporation. Health insurance. We said, you know, health insurance shouldn't be for profit. Blue Cross Blue Shield, all over the country, they were nonprofit corporations. They were run privately, but they had to be on a nonprofit basis. And the reason why, well, if it's for profit, then you've got a situation where you got to take, you know, skim 10% off the top to pay the stockholders their dividends. You got a CEO who's going to make, you know, a couple million bucks a year. You got the company jet. You got advertising. You got marketing. You got competition. You got all these expenses that are associated with for-profit businesses. So we said it shouldn't be for profit. And we are seeing the wisdom of that. Because over the last 15 years, as privatization of our hospitals has occurred in community after community, and people like Bill Frist's family have become incredibly, I mean, billionaires out of buying up little county hospitals when they went private and then making them more efficient, squeezing the blood out of them. And then, you know, guess what? Our healthcare costs have gone up 56% in 4 years. Can you put two and two together? I think it's time to say, if it has to do with healthcare, it's not for profit. You can still build an empire. You can build a not-for-profit empire. No problem. And people will. There's no shortage of them out there. But you can't operate on a for-profit basis. If you have to do with our pharmaceuticals, oh, my God, he's saying to make the drug companies nonprofit. Yes, that's right. That's what I'm saying. Drug companies should be not-for-profit. And frankly, I think that we should have a single-payer healthcare system. You know, Medicare, you know, I thought it was so weird the other night in the debate when George W. Bush said he wants to give you, he's talking about government health insurance. I'm not going to give you government health insurance. And this was just after Bush had gotten done bragging about increasing Medicare, which is government health insurance. I think we simply ought to expand Medicare and say, let's make Medicare available to everybody and fully fund it, 100%. One single provider. Let all the insurance companies go out of business. Let them find something else to do with their time. This will liberate a lot of energy in the United States. And all the money that we will save, we can put into improving our health care services. We can do it. Billy in Santa Cruz on the line. Hey, Billy, what's up?
Hey, guy. Well, I don't know that we should make our drug companies not-for-profit, but we absolutely should be rid of the insurance business.
Yeah. It's organized
crime.
You
know, we can't call ourselves the greatest country on earth as long as we're not paying for the health care of everybody else.
Yeah, of us. It's not even an everybody else. It's us. It's we taking care of
Americans.
Us.
Americans, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, well, Congress knows what's important. They're busy worrying about whether under God is in the pledge. But under God, we can all die without health care. And under God, we can, well, never mind. You know what that's all about.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about John O'Neill.
Billy, I got to ask you to hold. Billy, I'm gonna bring you back right after the break and give you a chance to make the point, okay? It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour, helping you win the water cooler wars.
Bonjour, my name is Véronique Raskin. I founded the Organic Wine Company 25 years ago. If you love wine and have not tried our French wines, you are in for a treat. Nowadays, people everywhere are buying organic fruits and vegetables because they know they taste better. Organic grapes are so luscious. When turned into wine, you can really taste the difference with every sip. So our wines are delicious and eco-friendly. So I want to make it easy for you to try them out. Call me right away at 1-888-ECO-WINE and I will send you three of my favorite organically grown French wines at half off the regular price. That's just $25 plus shipping. Isn't that magnifique? I think so. If you don't share my enthusiasm, I'll gladly refund your money. So take me up on my offer and call me at 1-888-ECO-WINE. ECOWINE. Au revoir.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more information and more about Mike's other novels, visit iowapeace.com. The revolution won't be televised, but you can read about it. The Last Liberal Outlaw, A New American Revolution, is happening in the heartland.
It's time for This Billionaire Moment.
Critics say that when we consolidate the media into fewer and fewer hands, it threatens diversity. Nothing could be further from the truth. Every demographic has different consuming habits. With 500 channels, we'll have one shopping network for Elvis memorabilia and another for the dogs playing poker crowd. Something for everyone. In this spirit, we billionaires are buying up the airwaves. If you're on a road trip from Kennebunkport to Crawford, you can tune into Rush the whole trip down. Just think, the same country and soft rock stations everywhere you go. And what we leave off the dial, you're better off without, really. Aren't you glad someone's protecting you from polka music? You're welcome. I'm Xenophobe for This Billionaire Moment.
This Billionaire Moment is brought to you by BillionairesForBush.com.
This is a Workers Independent News Service feature story. I'm Sarah Turner. The second presidential debate focuses on domestic policy, and no one is more concerned about the next president's plan for working people than America's labor unions. SEIU launched what it's calling a Heroes Program in 14 battleground states to get out the Kerry vote. Tracy Surprise, member of the SEIU Heroes Program, goes door to door talking to people about the issues.
You can talk about the statistics of health care and the number of people who have no health care, but I get to see the faces.
Surprise worked as a full-time nurse before becoming involved in the program.
This woman that I met the other day, whose daughter is on her third round of chemotherapy for a lymphoma, a type of cancer. And how she and her family members have mortgaged their houses because the daughter ran out of the health care insurance. But it's like, this is the type of story that I guess kind of moves me to keep doing what I'm doing and to reaffirm to me that we need some serious change in this country.
Manuel Veon left his job at the Madison Concourse Hotel 6 months ago to work as an SEIU hero.
The Iraq War is the other common theme. You know, I talked to family members who have lost, you know, their son or daughter due to the war. The past 4 years, you know, under the current administration, things haven't gotten any better. And that's why, you know, when you go out and vote, you should think about not just one issue, but many other issues. And keep your mind open to the different issues that are involved with this upcoming election. And to pay close attention to the debates to know the differences between the candidates. And I really care about those issues. And, you know, we're trying to do something about that.
Surprise and Veon are two of the more than 2,000 people that have left their regular jobs to educate and register voters. With the Workers Independent News Service, I'm Sarah Turner.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
One day today, two yesterday, and five the day before. So tell us soon what we can do to end this needless war.
And welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We were talking to Billy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Billy.
Hey, bud. You know, I was thinking about how Richard Nixon, Jesus, he won't go away.
Yeah.
And by that...
His ghost is haunting George W.
Absolutely. And it's haunting all of us, because you know this jerk, this liar, John O'Neill?
Mm-hmm. The guy that Richard Nixon hired to politically assassinate John Kerry.
He is
in 72.
Monster.
Yeah.
Totally created by Nixon, and doesn't understand that maybe he should have his own life, and he's still doing this.
Yeah.
It's his only meaning he's being able to have. Talk about an empty vessel.
Well, it may be the times in his life when he actually made the most money.
Oh, absolutely. You know he gets paid well to do this.
Yeah, and he was back then.
Fly first class.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk about Sinclair real quick.
Sure.
So let me see if I understand media concentration. We shouldn't have to worry about it because the owners are going to behave in ways, wait a minute, they're not. The owners aren't behaving in ways.
Surprise!
Wow.
Surprise!
You know, if we do ever get control of anything again, I think that the FCC has to just break up media in so many little pieces, it will be unrecognizable.
Well, this is largely the way it was until Hearst really was the first guy that consolidated media in a big way, and there was a huge reaction against that in the United States.
And media's gone wrong ever since then. And again, remember, we have to blame media for the fact that George Bush is so unhappy when he gets asked tough questions. He's had no practice, and that's due to the media. And the last thing, of course, is the Ten Commandments. I hear that's back.
Yeah, well, they're going to be pulling wedge issues out of their back pockets. You know, I mean, they're hysterical. They're frantic.
What the Christians need to realize is they're exactly like the Taliban.
They are
Taliban.
Yeah, except that they're better with words. You see the other day where Newt Gingrich issued his new fatwa. He got a bunch of Republicans together, and he said, stop talking about flip-flop, and stop using the word flip-flop, and start using the word liberal. He says our testing on focus groups shows that liberal produces a more negative response than flip-flop.
And
so all
of them are following him,
and they including the good cheap and chief.
The cheap.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah,
thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Billy. Good to hear from you. Amazing times we live in. It's really, in many ways, a privilege to be alive right now, you know, because we can do something about this. We really can. You and me, we can get involved and we can do something about this. We can create a better world for the next generation, which is, I think, the obligation of every generation. Thanks to Louise for producing our show today, to Ira for engineering it, to Brad for our music, to Shelby for streaming us around the world. Thanks to Mike Toth and Ben Birch for our archives, to Jay for our theme music. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Great to see you here. Learn a lot from you. And thanks to you for listening. It's particularly appreciated. See you tomorrow. Same time, same place.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Visit iowapeace.com for books on justice and peace. The Last Liberal Outlaw is Mike Palasek's new novel. Chuck Gregory with BlueEar.com had this to say. Palasek is at his best when writing about small-town America. It's a place he clearly loves, even as he pokes fun at its quirks and reveals the sickness that lies just below the surface. It's a place he knows, and he shares his knowledge in delightfully original ways, even as he cries out for change. We haven't had a writer like Palasek since Kurt Vonnegut was at his peak. Mike is an Iowa author, former federal prisoner for peace, small-town newspaper reporter, seminarian, and nominee for the U.S. House of Representatives in the Iowa Democratic Party 2000 election. For more